space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
You're listening to Mad Science at www.chazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html, where you have access to not one but four separate chat rooms. Plus, if you scroll down there underneath the chat rooms, you'll find a link to People for People Radio Network. Those are some wonderful people over there. Go over there and join their chat as well. And also check out Wolf Spirit Radio. So today's subject that I want to talk about, first I need to say that tomorrow's Knights of the Round Table show won't be live because There's a birthday party that is my wife's mother's birthday that I must attend, and so I won't be here tomorrow. Sorry about that, but we'll make it up in a future broadcast. So anyway, there's a deal going on down in Florida that they call Red Tide, and so I wanted to get into a few things like this. See, solving the world's problems is an easy thing to do. It's getting people to understand information and act upon the solutions available to, resolve these issues. That's the hard part. So with that said, I'm going to play a couple little podcast things here just to give those folks that don't understand what Red Tide is a general idea of what these folks are talking about. So I'm just going to play this live. I might want to jump in here every once in a while if I hear something I need to say.
Craig, do they know what's causing this red tide or fueling it? And is there anything the state can do about it?
Well, let's start with the organism. Red tide is caused by a microorganism called K. brevis. And it's something that feeds off of a variety of nutrients. And it is spread in the Gulf by Gulf currents and by wind patterns. And this is ultimately what you get. You have a microorganism that produces toxins that kills marine life at the lower end of the food chain, and that can poison shellfish and seagrass, which sickens marine life as you work up the food chain. Toxins also seep into the air, sickens people, particularly those with pre-existing breathing conditions. Red tide in itself, by the way, is nothing new. There are accounts of this off Florida coast for hundreds of years, long before Florida became commercially developed. But environmentalists say commercial development is certainly feeding it, making it far worse than it would otherwise be. And that's because this microorganism can feed off the nutrients in fertilizer that can seep from farms or lawns into the water. We know South Florida's Lake Okeechobee has been polluted with this kind of fertilizer runoff, and this polluted water from the lake has certainly been flowing into the Gulf to our south. So we have a clear correlation here between that flow of polluted water from Lake Okeechobee, which can feed red tide, to the red tide that we're seeing in the Gulf. But scientists have not drawn a direct link. They have not said that pollution has directly caused this outbreak of red tide. Again, red tide can and does occur naturally, and it feeds off of a variety of nutrients. In terms of what the state can do, obviously there's a growing focus on efforts to restrict or prevent pollutants like fertilizer from seeping into our water. Years ago, the state had a plan to buy out much of the commercial sugar farms near Lake Okeechobee, but that plan ultimately fell apart.
Yeah, and so this is not the same microorganism, the one called the green goop versus the red tide. These are different things?
Yes, they are different things. The blue-green algae bloom that you're seeing in Lake Okeechobee, that's caused by cyanobacteria, not K. brevis. K. brevis needs salt water to thrive, but cyanobacteria in the lake also feeds off of pollution from things like septic tank leakage and nitrogen and phosphorus-based fertilizer. And that cyanobacteria in the lake also causes health problems, and researchers believe long-term exposure may be linked to some very serious conditions, including Alzheimer's and ALS. So yes, we're talking about two different kinds of microorganisms, one causing the mess that we're seeing inland and the other causing the mess we're seeing in saltwater along the beaches, but they both can feed off of the same type of nutrient pollution which has been flowing from farms in South Florida into Lake Okeechobee and has also been flowing from the lake into the Gulf, which brings us right back to that correlation we're seeing, but not necessarily a causation as it relates to what we're seeing, particularly on the beaches from Manatee County South.
And before you go, Craig, I just have to ask you, is there any sign yet that the state is looking at this as some kind of an emergency, given there's tourist dollars at stake, fishermen, I mean, so many people's livelihoods in Florida are tied to the water?
Well, Governor Scott has noted a state emergency, which does affect the way that the water can subsequently flow. There also is a very vigorous debate already in state government in terms of what more can be done, but that ultimately will be decided by who succeeds Governor Scott starting next year with a regular session in which lawmakers follow.
All right. Thanks so much, Craig.
All right, and for the record, I did send Rick Scott an email and see if I could put my 2 cents worth in there to try to resolve things. See, first off, people got to understand what the heck is actually occurring to begin with. What algae is, and you know, the different things that compete with algae and such. What algae's purpose is. A simple little definition right here, I guess. When you Google up algae, function of algae. Algae are aquatic photosynthetic organisms. Defining the function of an organism depends on the context. Algae play an important role in the global carbon cycle by fixing carbon dioxide into edible polysaccharides. Sorry about that. And other high-energy carbon molecules. So basically, what that basically just explained is algae does a job. It takes, you know, the carbon, just like the photosynthesis that, you know, regular plants do. It takes the carbon off and releases oxygen for the fish. So it not only does a job at that, but it also does a job of, you know, controlling the chemistry as far as... you know, eating waste that different types of bacteria that are, you know, get out of control. So basically, algae is one of nature's cleaners. And so when there's a problem, then you'll get a lot of algae that will form in that particular problem area. And so when you understand exactly what's going on, then you know how to actually address the situation. See, down in Florida, there's some sugar farms down there. And inadvertently, while the sugar farmers are actually, you know, trying to make their crops be able to grow well as and profitable, they basically over fertilize. That's the simple of the deal. You know, they use techniques like using anhydrous ammonia to add chemistry to the soil, you know, nitrogen and such, and they use different types of fertilizers, and you know, in some instances, like around where I live, where all the farmers, they'll use some bits of manure and stuff like that, and different types of fertilizers and anhydrous ammonia. Well, this does something good for their crops by making the water really, or not the water, but the soil really super highly nutrient rich, which the crops will thrive in. However, whatever the crops aren't using, when it does rain and all that runoff goes down into other waterways, then that highly nutrient-rich soil and fertilizer, different chemistry, go down into these waterways, and they make the water so super highly nutrient-rich that any algae that would be normally in there doing its job of keeping the... you know, the water balanced and all that, is now thriving. And it's thriving to the extent that it causes, you know, overgrowth of algae in that particular area, pond or stream or whatever. And so when that happens, it starts to cause a chain reaction that basically when... like a pond. Where I live, we use duckweed and watermill. Or we don't use it, nature uses it to actually filter out the water. Well, if this stuff gets completely covered and over the top of the pond, and there's nothing in the pond that will eat this particular plant or whatever, then it will actually cover the entire pond, blocking out the sunlight, breaking down the ecosystem up underneath that pond. So, because you need the sunlight to, you know, get down to other plants that live down at the bottom, and, you know, basically the pond can actually become stagnant for a period of time. However, there's a plus to this deal. See, nature knows how to balance things out. So if you're seeing a pond that is completely covered with green, whether it be algae, duckweed, or watermill, any of these other plants that thrive in highly nutrient-rich water, that is nature's way of cleaning that water back up to try to find balance in that water. Well, in the process, if it's blocking out the sunlight, it can actually deprive the fish of oxygen causing the fish to die. Well, of course, as the fish die, it makes the water yet even more highly nutrient rich, as you know, the fish are being recycled into the system. So what you need to understand is first the cause of what, why this is actually occurring. You know, you could have a really beautiful pond and plenty of fish and everything, and then the farmer during the season of farming, he'll fertilize his land really heavily, and then that fertilizer, when it rains, which is what the water, the rain is necessary for to help to promote the plant growth as well, but that rain then in turn washes off excess fertilizer down into the waterways that then in turn causes these overgrowths of algae, duckweed, and watermill, and any plants like that. And so that then in turn blocks out the sunlight, which deprives anything underneath that from the sunlight. And you need the sunlight for the plants to get down through the water to, for the whole entire photosynthesis thing. Algae will actually produce oxygen, but at a certain extent, when the pond is completely covered and it doesn't have any sunlight to it, the only thing that would be getting the sunlight would be the algae or the duckweed or watermill. So they're growing great. They're doing just fine. It's the ecosystem below that. However, if you pay attention whenever you go check out these situations and you skim back the water, you'll note that the water underneath that that doggone duckweed is like super fresh. I mean, you could clear, it's crystal clear. You can see all the way to the bottom. And so, with that said, understand the start to finish. There's another episode, like especially in Florida, there are freshwater lakes in Florida. And these freshwater lakes, when the water basically goes from freshwater and then starts to mix in with salt water, you'll notice that there's some discoloration. There's a term called brackish water that has more salt than freshwater, but not as much as seawater. It may result in mixing of seawater with freshwater, as in estuaries, or it may occur in brackish fossil aquifers. The word comes from Middle Dutch, whatever. Anyway, years ago, whenever I was down in Florida, I happened to notice that the parts where the streams are actually running into the salt water, the water would be all discolored and everything. Well, that's because there are certain biological things that live in freshwater that can't live in salt water. So when these two waters come to mix, these certain little biological cells or whatever, bacterias or even algae for that matter, they can't live in salt water. They're not adapted to it. So when they mix, they start to die. Well, that makes that particular area right there highly nutrient, and then you'll get that red algae that comes over to feed off of this high nutrients. So, basically, understanding how nature's functioning to begin with, to try to keep itself in balance, that will actually unlock the door to the solutions out there. There's a lady named Dr. Lorraine Day that wrote a book years ago, Diseases Don't Just Happen. And how does this relate to what it is that I'm talking about? I hope you understand here in a second. But basically, she takes and breaks down the chemistry of the body. And she says that, you got these different portions of the body that do these different types of function, and without these particular minerals, or, you get too high a concentrate of this mineral, this is what causes your body to go out of balance, and then it eventually ends up causing a disease that, could end up taking your life and such. I'll post a link down to one of her videos, or just her name and everything. And if you Google that, if you jump over to Super Chat and you Google Dr. Lorraine Day and just listen to what she's talking about, diseases don't just happen, then you understand the correlation of why it is that I'm talking about, what's going on with nature, because it's the one and the same. Your body's a chemistry set. Nature's a chemistry set. And when nature's off balance, then basically nature has things set into place to try to put things back in balance. One of those things that nature uses to put things back in balance is duckweed. Florida actually has duckweed that grows there. It's got a technical term, Spirodella poly, polyhesa. Anyway, I don't like the high-tech terminologies. Duckweed's just an easier way to say it. Giant duckweed is a native floating plant in Florida. Though very small, it is the largest of the duckweeds. There's that word again, Spirodella polyurethra. Why do the scientists got to put these crazy old tongue-twisting names on stuff? Just call it duckweed for Pete's sake. It's frequently found growing in rivers, ponds, lakes, sloughs from the peninsula west of the central panhandle of Florida. Okay, so I can get rid of that there picture right there. Let me find my little deal down here. Alright, so I posted a deal down in the thing that I actually sent off to Rick Scott, Governor Rick Scott of Florida. And duckweed, basically I'm just going to read a little section of it. Duckweed also functions as a bioremediator. Man, I need to learn how to freaking read. Effectively filtering contaminants such as bacteria, nitrogen, phosphates, and other nutrients from naturally occurring bodies of water, constructed wetlands and waterlands. And so basically what I was trying to put out here is that used as a buffer between the sugar fields and Lake Okeechobee, which is where they're saying they're having the problem at, this plant will filter extra nutrients and contaminants. The green algae has nothing at this point to compete with. So if you got a highly nutrient-rich water and the algae's growing wild and it doesn't have anything that can eat it fast enough, like there are natural algae eaters, which I actually put a link to freshwater algae eaters in this fishkeepingadvice.com, I believe it is. And then there's also a link to saltwater algae eaters as well that I posted in this same deal. So nature has the tools in order to resolve the algae problem. And the deal is, basically, inadvertently, we kind of help to throw things off of balance. Nature does, this red algae is not a new phenomenon. It's something that's been occurring even before, you know, industrial age. And basically, that's for the same reason why I explained when the salt water, or when the fresh water, with all its organisms in it, clashes with the salt water, that there are certain organisms that cannot survive in saltwater environments, certain plants that cannot survive in saltwater. So when they die, it now become nutrients and food for the red algae on the other side. So understanding that, there's no way you can actually get rid of the entirety of the red tide, but if you understand it, then you can at least regulate your activity to keep from making this a worse scenario than it is. See, red algae actually has a toxin that it can release that actually kills off wildlife. And basically that killing off of the wildlife then in turn makes the fish more food for the red algae. So if it doesn't have any kind of nutrients to live on, it actually has a functioning mechanism to basically make food by killing off some of the wildlife. And so all of what nature has done, everything, you know, even the red algae, the green algae, there's so many different types of algae, it's ridiculous. But Now, either way, all of these things are nature's little cleaners, you know, that clean up different types of bacteria so that they don't get out of hand, and all the way up to the different types of plants that actually absorb nutrients and stuff like that. This is the reason why I'm trying to emphasize about this duckweed. And since duckweed's already, in Florida, it's not like bringing a species out to introduce into the environment to try to, fight off something that, got out of control. So, the simple of the deal is that if they use duckweed as a buffer zone between the runoff of the farmer's field to catch any nutrients and absorb this, then it's less likely that that was actually going to make it down and through when they release water from Lake Okeechobee down into the streams that are going to make it down to the ocean side. And so basically there's a plus to all this, and I'll get to that in a second. Let's see, where are we at on functions of algae? I already read that. Algae's got some really good potential uses, one of which, let's see, I just saw this just a little while ago. Algae, there's a website out there called www.nature.com, and there's an article which you posted a link, or if I hadn't posted, I will post. There's an article where they're talking about algae holds promise for nuclear cleanup because of what some of the functions of what algae does. Organism ability to distinguish strontium from calcium could help in dealing with nuclear waste. And so I'll post that link down here in the super chat as well. So there's a potential thing that that algae could actually be used for, or usefulness. If you watch what nature's actually doing, then you'll see that some of these things that we think are like really terrible are really not bad. And if you learn how nature is functioning, then you can use these same techniques to assist nature. You know, whenever you want to grow your food in the farm field, you understand that you don't have to fertilize certain ways. You could actually use, different things that nature's already done to fertilize your crops and stuff, which would make it where it was safer for your environment down the line. So it's like tipping the first domino. If the farmer, just like I explained, if the farmer fertilizes his land and the rain comes and the rain washes all that runoff down into your pond, now your pond becomes super highly nutrient rich, and any algae that are available down there, any duckweeds or water mills that are down there, will thrive. I mean, they got plenty of food. You just fatten them up, and so that's what the strongest things going on in there right now. Then it just overgrows, and then it blocks out the sunlight and starts to tip, dominoes tipping in the other direction. So let me see here. There are another podcast I want to play if I can get down there. Let's try this one right here.
Hi, I'm Rhonda Watkins. I'm with Collier County Pollution Control, and we've been monitoring red tide in Collier County since about 1996. When I first started monitoring red tide, I had a lot of questions, and I bet you have the same questions that I had. So hopefully I can answer some of those for you, maybe dispel some of the myths that you keep hearing about red tide. So let's get started. So what is Florida red tide? There are actually different kinds of red tide, and we have one specific to Florida. It's a microscopic plant, and it's a dinoflagellate, and if you can see in this picture, you can actually see the two tails that make that the dinoflagellate and allow this organism to move. It produces a toxin, but it's best known for causing fish kills, making you sneeze and cough, and ruining vacations. So it's always present in the Gulf of Mexico, but has periods of accelerations, and we call those blooms. But is it really red? Well, kind of. If it blooms in a high enough concentration, you can actually get a reddish tint to the water as seen in this picture. But we don't want you to get it confused with other red tides around the world, because they do happen. The Florida red tides are actually caused by Karenia brevis, and Karenia brevis blooms occur mostly in the Gulf of Mexico. We can occasionally get them hitting the Gulf, the current that runs up the East Coast, and they can actually get red tides on the East Coast. It does cause respiratory irritation, it causes fish kills, and it causes neurotoxic shellfish poisoning. It can cause marine mammal deaths. But don't get it confused with red drift algae, which looks like this. So you may have seen this on the beach, and while it does cause some odors when it's decomposing, the red drift algae isn't anything like our Florida red tide. So the human impacts. Our red tide does cause respiratory irritation. Produces a neurotoxin called brevetoxin that is released from the cell into the water. So what happens is this cell actually has a very thin cell wall, and when the waves hit it, it can break that cell apart and releases the toxin into the water. Then when you inhale the sea spray that's coming off the beach, you actually inhale the toxin. The toxins have actually been measured as far inland as 1 mile, and the common symptoms with breathing, inhaling the red tide toxin include coughing, sneezing, and watery eyes. Now, I would get a lot of people saying that they've been exposed to red tide when they live out in Golden Gate Estates, and that's not going to happen. You actually physically have to be in contact with the red tide toxin in order for you to react to it. So everyone has varying levels of sensitivities, just like allergies. Some people might be affected by going into a smoky room and other people may not. So you could have two people at the beach. One may feel the red tide and one may not. But typically most people, even healthy people that react to it, once you leave the beach and you remove yourself from the contact of that sea spray, the symptoms typically go away. But we do caution people that have chronic respiratory problems like asthma or emphysema that they typically stay away from the beach when red tide is occurring. It can trigger asthma attacks, and there have been studies that show that asthmatics typically have a prolonged reaction to it, and it can take up to more than a week for them to recover. And then I've heard since I've been monitoring red tide that anecdotal stories of, I got the worst cold of my life when I went to the beach and there was red tide. But now they're finding out that red tide can actually increase your immune response, and so your body reacts to the exposure of the red tide. It's not typically the red tide, but allows other things to come in, and like colds and things like that. There was an actual study done by Moat Marine Lab in 2006 that did show an increased emergency room visits just because people were coughing and had asthma attacks and pneumonia and bronchitis, and they were indicating that could be from the red tide. So does that mean if there's red tide that you can't go to the beach? No, because you have to have three things happen for you to feel the red tide at the beach. You have to have a high enough red tide level, you have to have wave action, and the wind has to be blowing in your direction for you to feel red tide. So if one of those things doesn't happen, you can go to the beach and you wouldn't even know red tide was there. But the problem with red tide is that the conditions can change from hour to hour and tide to tide. So you can get a patch of red tide at Barefoot Beach in North Collier that may, in a couple of hours, get pushed down to Seagate Beach. And people that were feeling it at Barefoot Beach may feel it in the morning and they may not feel it in the afternoon. But what about if you live on the beach or you live close to the beach? You're probably best to close your windows because the air conditioner will filter out the sea spray particles. And if you're really sensitive to it and you have problems even getting to your car or you like to go and walk on the beach, you can't actually put a mask on to keep the sea spray out of your lungs and you shouldn't feel any of the symptoms. Can you swim during red tide? Again, I go back to the people that have different sensitivities to it because different people react to it in different ways. So some people can go swimming in it and not have any effects. Other people may get a rash, but typically if you get out and wash off, you're not going to have any symptoms. Shellfish poisoning is another thing that Karenia brevis can cause, and it's a neurotoxic shellfish poisoning. If you're familiar with any kind of red tide events on the East Coast and the Northeast Coast, it's a different type of shellfish poisoning. It's called paralytic shellfish poisoning, and that has been actually known to kill people. The type of shellfish poisoning that we get here does not. It typically causes numbness and tingling in the mouth, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, and a reversal of hot-cold sensation. So that means something that typically feels hot now feels cold, and something that cold now feels hot. There have been no documented cases of human death from neurotoxic shellfish poisoning. So what about going to your favorite restaurant or going to your favorite seafood market to get any kind of clams or oysters? Those are all collected from monitored locations. They are strictly regulated and tested for brevetoxin. So feel comfortable going to your favorite restaurant during red tide and ordering your oysters because they're perfectly safe to eat. But do not go out and harvest shellfish on your own. Don't go out on the beach to get coquina clams or get some oysters off your dock because red tide toxin does not cook out. It doesn't freeze out. And you can't taste it, so you wouldn't know it was there. So other seafood. I get questions about, can I eat fish during a red tide? Well, it's actually the meat of the fish is fine because the muscle tissue does not contain the toxins. So if the fish was acting normal when you caught it, that means you didn't see this big grouper swimming at the top and acting weird and you just netted it and pulled it in. Actually, you caught it by hook and line and it put up a good fight and it looks healthy, then eating that muscle tissue is fine. You never want to consume any kind of fish that is already dead or just acting just not normal. And then crabs and shrimp are safe to eat because they don't concentrate the toxins in their meat either. And just to clarify, the fish, fish are actually killed by red tide through suffocation, and not typically how you think. They're not poisoned because they don't concentrate the toxin in their tissues. What happens is because it's a neurotoxic shellfish poisoning, when that toxin goes through their gills and releases the toxin, it actually paralyzes them. And as you know, fish have to move to be able to breathe. And when they can't move, they end up suffocating. You can get kills from low oxygen in backwater bays when the bloom gets back there and can't get flushed out by normal tides and currents. And then the red tide just dies off, and while it's dying, it actually consumes oxygen. The other thing about red tide is, remember those two tails that we looked at? It can move up and down in the water column. So in the daytime, it comes up to the top where it can reach the sunlight and actually photosynthesize. And then at nighttime, it actually goes down to the bottom where there are more nutrients and it's a little better protected. So you'll see typically bottom fish that are first ones that are killed. So we'll get catfish and batfish and mullet and things like that washing up on the beach first. And that's because the red tide is actually moving through the water column. Other marine life that are affected by red tide are manatees, dolphin, sea turtles, and birds. And they're kind of all eating red tide as they feed. Some of the fish that concentrate the red tide in their actual gut, the ones that actually feed on plankton, can pass that into to the marine life and then when they're in the water breathing it 24/7. So imagine yourself in a smoky bar for 3 months, how that's going to affect your respiratory system. So typically what's going on is the animals are exposed to the toxin and their respiratory system becomes extremely distressed. They typically recover if you can get them out in time, but if they develop pneumonia just because they've had that chronic irritation for months at a time, that's typically what does them in. Manatees can actually eat red tide by consuming seagrass, and they found that the red tide toxin can actually last on the seagrass blades for months after the red tide is actually gone. And we had the worst manatee mortality in 2013 when we got hit with a severe cold front that not only killed a lot of fish due to temperatures, but it also, with the manatees exposed to red tide and the cold, we had 277 manatees die that year. So what about pets? Yes, dogs can be affected if they're eating dead fish on the beach. So if you have a dog and there's red tide, it's not a good idea to take your dog to the beach. So how do we know when red tide is here? We actually have 5 locations that we sample weekly. And then we have some 4 stations down around Marco Island that Rookery Bay samples for us. Usually twice a week if there's actually, or a couple times a month when there's red tide. So we've been sampling these sites since 1995. And at the time we started the sampling, we just went out when we thought there was a red tide, and we took samples just to confirm that it was red tide. But it's not really a good way to set up a scientific monitoring program. So we added fixed stations in 2013, and those are the five stations, Barefoot Beach, Vanderbilt Beach, Seagate Beach, Naples Pier, and South Marco Beach. And we sample those every week. And then anything done offshore, because we don't have a boat or access to offshore sampling, is typically done by Florida Fish and Wildlife or Moat Marine Lab. So how do you find out where the red tide is? You can call the red tide hotline at 239-252-2591. Unfortunately, results from the state can actually take up to 48 hours after analysis. So we could collect a sample on Monday, and we won't actually get the results until Wednesday. We also have a red tide update e-notice, which you can sign up for at www.callyourgov.net, and there are e-notice updates, and just click the one for the red tide report. It gives you the same information as the red tide hotline. We also have beach signs that are deployed when red tide is anywhere in Collier County, including the city of Naples. And then the National Weather Service has actually added a little icon to their, if you use the app, the weather app, on your phone, and you'll notice like a little icon that gives you an exclamation point that might say there's rip currents or something like that. When there's red tide in the area, they'll actually indicate that there's possible respiratory irritation at the beach. The only problem with that is that it's a huge area that doesn't tell you which beach. So these are the signs that we have deployed at the beaches. So if there's no red tide in the area, we just have this pretty sign in the shells that you might find on the beach. And if there is red tide, then we have the sign flip to indicate red tide is present. And this is done a lot for people that are visiting Collier County, because they're not going to look at the newspaper or, you know, look on Facebook or social media. That they probably don't even know what red tide is, but we want to give them a little bit of warning in case they get out there and start coughing and don't know why. So the reporting, so real-time reporting has always been an issue because red tide is so patchy. And if we take that sample on Monday and we're not getting results until Wednesday, that red tide could have completely changed. It could have moved. It could have gotten worse. We could have dead fish on the beach. So now we've added back the beach conditions report. We actually had this reporting system back in 2008 when Moat Marine Lab had a grant that covered several counties, including Collier County, and they lost funding for their grant, but we now have it back online. We've got four locations in Collier County, and the park rangers will report at each beach whether or not there's dead fish or respiratory irritation or red drift algae or trash or what the crowds look like. And you can access this from the website. They have a mobile app that you can download for free, and you can also call their hotline. The actual website is visitbeaches.org, and here's what it looks like. So when you get to the website, you can just click on one of your beaches, and it will give you the information about that beach, including water temperature if you need to know. So you can make an informed decision about which beach you want to go to, because we may have red tide at one beach on the north end of the county, and the south end of the county is perfectly fine. And so now we have daily updates to let you know which beach you can go to. So can we predict when and where red tide is going to occur? Kinda. So the blooms typically start 40 to 50 miles offshore near the loop current, and I'm going to show you where that is in a minute. And then it's brought into shore by currents and wind. But no one has been successful about trying to predict when it's going to happen, how long it's going to stay, and when it's going to die off. So this is a loop current. It comes up from the Yucatan, and it comes into the Gulf of Mexico, and then enters the Gulf Stream up along the East Coast. So the red tide actually occurs kind of on the northeast corner, and that loop current brings up nutrient-rich water from the bottom, which stimulates the red tide to bloom. Now, red tide is present in the Gulf of Mexico at all times somewhere. It just may not be in bloom at bloom conditions. And then that red tide will come in along the shoreline. So can we predict when and where? We have tools now to track where it's going once it's here. In addition to the sampling we're doing, they have gliders that they can actually put out in the water and program them to go out and collect samples and find out whether or not there's brevetoxin in the water. And we also use satellite imagery to track the chlorophyll levels in the water. And we use all of these to help minimize impacts and find out where red tide is going so we can warn people in advance. And another useful website is the USF Collaboration for Prediction of Red Tide. It's one that I use that actually gives like a three-day projection of where red tide might be going. And the science is getting better every day. So the NOAA satellite imagery started in 2004, and they were using our sampling to actually ground truth some of the images they were using. But it detects chlorophyll levels in the water, and they can track where the bloom is going. The only drawbacks to it is if there's a cloudy day, they can't really see the chlorophyll in the water. And sometimes it can get confused with other types of blooms, but they typically err on the side of caution and indicate if they see chlorophyll in the water, that's probably red tide. So here's a typical satellite image from NOAA, and this is from last October when we had red tide, and you can see the patch, and I'll zoom in. You can see the patch of red tide that's off our coastline, but you can also see that it goes all the way up into a Tampa Bay and Hillsborough County. And what you'll find with red tide is it always starts north of us. It never just shows up in Collier County without first having been north of us at some point and for some time. So what does red tide look like in Collier County? You can see by this graphic that probably the worst months for red tide to occur in Collier County are October, and then again November, February. And unfortunately, I kind of kid that red tide coincides with tourist season, but it unfortunately does. We have our highest peaks and our most fish kills during October through about April. So which month is the worst as far as red tide levels? So it may occur frequently in October, but it really ramps up and the levels of red tide get really bad in November. So how long does red tide last? I get a lot of questions of it's lasting longer than it ever has before. So using those fixations that we've been monitoring since 2003 and putting those on a graph, now you can see that red line is the trend line, and you see it's almost flat, indicating that the how long red tide lasts in Collier County really isn't changing. You can see some cycles in that data, and I bet if we started looking at a bigger picture of El Niños and La Niñas and things like that, that you might be able to see a pattern in that, but it's really not getting worse and lasting longer. And then the question is it getting worse year after year? So if we look back to 2003 again, you see the red line is the trend line indicating there's not really a change. It's not getting better. It's not getting worse. It's just kind of here. I also threw on the graphic the rainfall amounts. And so you can see in 2005 when we had Hurricane Wilma that we had increased rainfall. And then the next year, we had a higher red tide level. But then if you look in 2012, we had a fairly high red tide level. And then again in 2013, but the rain wasn't really ramping up. So what this tells me, and I get questions all the time about, is runoff causing red tide? You have to understand that red tide is a Gulf-wide issue. So when we get things like hurricanes, we're getting runoff in the Gulf of Mexico. It's not just in Collier County. And so if this red tide is happening in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and then coming inshore to our north, that's more of a Gulf-wide issue. So we can't target just Collier County to say things that are happening in Collier County are making red tide worse. Now the question also arises, is runoff sustaining red tide? Well, you'll see by these graphics that it's not lasting any longer than it has been. So that would indicate that runoff may not be sustaining it at all, but it's an algae. It uses nutrients for food. So certainly nutrients could make it last longer around our shoreline. But it's not like a northeastern red tide where they get rain events and then immediately get a red tide following that. Because, you know, we get rain down here in Collier County. We get more rain down here than they do up in the Panhandle. They do get red tides in the Panhandle, but we're not getting any more than they are. So what causes red tide? Well, that's the billion-dollar question. So we have to kind of look at the history of red tide. We know it's here all the time. We know it's been here in the Gulf of Mexico for a long time. There are actually captain's logs from early Spanish explorers in the 1500s that were talking about the same kind of symptoms that red tide gives us. So they were coughing, sneezing, and there were dead fish. But we actually had the first documented case, like somebody actually went out and found it in the water in 1844. And then the organism that causes it was actually discovered in 1947, or actually named in 1947. So that predates really any kind of industry in Florida, and really before we were overly populated along the coastline. So in order to understand what makes something happen, you have to understand how it works. So there are multiple things that affect red tide growth. Salinity, temperature, nutrients, ocean currents, and wind currents. This little organism can actually feed off other blooms. So we could have a different organism blooming in the Gulf of Mexico, and red tide can actually gather food from that. It can actually inhibit the growth of other plankton. So that may be why when we get a red tide bloom, maybe it persists for a while because it's not letting anything else grow and it's pretty much eating all the food. They do know that red tide can use multiple forms of nitrogen. So if you take that food source away, in any one situation, it's going to find another way to eat. And a good indication of that is, why does red tide kill fish? So there aren't a lot of fish that eat red tide as a food source, because if we don't have blooms all the time, the fish that would rely on red tide aren't going to survive. So why would red tide need to kill fish? Well, they found that with the lack of phosphorus in the water, red tide actually has the ability to turn on and turn off its toxin emitters. So when it runs out of food, specifically phosphorus, it can turn on its toxin emitters and kill fish, and now all of a sudden it has a new food source. So nutrients could be looked at as good or bad. If we have red tide in the water and we don't have a lot of dead fish, that might indicate we have a lot of nutrients, but then we're not going to have fish kills at the beach. If we don't have a lot of nutrients in the water and we're going to get red tide, then we may get dead fish because we don't have the nutrients in the water. So too much of nutrients can sustain a bloom along the coastline, potentially. We're not really seeing that in the duration of our red tides in Collier County. But then too little nutrients can make it more toxic. And again, I kind of already talked about the runoff issue. The highest occurrence typically occurs during our dry season, in between October and February. So if it was a rain-driven thing, you would think it would really ramp up in the summer months, but it's not. One of the other things that are looking at red tide is it may not just function as one cell. The more they look at this thing on a genetic level, they're thinking that it might act as like a beehive, where they actually have worker cells and things like that. So, unfortunately, the more we learn about this little thing, the less we know. It's a very complicated thing, but you need to understand that it was here before we were, and it's not gonna go away. So why do we have it, and what happens if we completely eradicate red tide? Well, if you grew up like me, you grew up with the campaign with Smokey the Bear saying, put out all the forest fires. And we put forest fires out at all costs. We didn't want forest fires. But what do we do now? We actually start fires, because now we understand that some forest ecologies require fire to survive, to be productive. So I kind of like to think of red tide as a forest fire of the sea. It must have a purpose, since it's been here longer than we have. And so if we think of red tide as having an actual purpose in our oceans, it kind of gives us a different perspective. Again, you know, we can certainly help our coastline by reducing nutrients that are going into the water. So we're not feeding the red tide, but we'll never completely eradicate red tide. Thanks for watching. I hope you learned something about red tide, and I hope you had some questions answered today. But if you have any more questions, please call me. Again, I'm Rhonda Watkins with Collier County Pollution Control, and you can call us at 239-252-2502.
All right, so I hope that was pretty informative. While I was listening to that podcast, I was looking up watermill, which is another one. Watermill is let's see, I'm trying to find the actual description of it. Basically, it's another one of the plants like duckweed, and it has a purpose just like duckweed. And there are natural. While watermill is at least somewhat controlled, you will want to introduce pond fish that eat this plant, like grass carp. Koi will eat watermill readily, while grass carp may eat other plants first. They'll readily gobble up this annoying plant pest as long as you keep, as long as it's kept reasonable in check by other methods. Basically, this is like, I got 10 billion things running through my mind at one time. Anyway, over here where I live, there are like golf courses that use lots of fertilizers, and they want their grass to look really nice for their customers, you know. And in the process of using these fertilizers, when it rains, the fertilizers run off down into the pond, and it causes the ponds to, you know, get highly nutrient rich, which then in turn promotes either algaes, watermill, or duckweed to grow rapidly. And the thing about duckweed and watermill is they can double within 24 to 48 hours. If you got a little patch, it's double in size within that time frame because of the super highly nutrient-rich environment that it has right there. But some of their methods by which to get rid of it is to use herbicides in order to try to control it so that their ponds are not all green and nasty looking. And so that adds to the problem as well. Let's see, controlling of duckweed. I got a whole bunch of tabs open up here, so please bear with me. Given enough nutrients, duckweed and watermill can reproduce prolifically, can you pronounce that, and cover an entire pond within a few weeks after coming to the surface. They reproduce by budding, and in some cases can produce a new plant every 24 hours. Controlling duckweed and watermill is difficult and challenging. Alright, so you got to get down to the brass tacks of everything. What the heck is causing this to happen? Well, basically falls back on how nutrient rich that water is. And if the farmer is using anhydrous ammonia and all different types of other fertilizers and maybe even pesticides and stuff like that, then that runoff goes down and it throws the pond or waterways out of balance and causes it to go crazy. Of course, that's not the only thing either. Now, one of these podcasts, I don't know if she mentioned it in that one, but septic systems out on, urban or rural areas, which one would that be? Out in the countryside. Basically, nutrients can leach down into the waterways and, you know, basically make the water highly nutrient-rich that way as well. See, there are certain types of septic systems that have two tanks. There's the solid waste first tank that you get whenever you flush your toilet or whatever, and that waste goes down into the tank. And there are, you know, natural bacteria that are put into the tank, like Ridex is one of the deals that they use, like a bunch of different types of bacteria that go in there and they break down the waste. And then the next tank over basically helps to start to clean the water up yet even more. And then when it comes out of that second tank, then it goes into a what they call a potty pond, essentially. Inside that potty pond, you will note that there's tons of duckweed in there. duckweed and watermill. And that is to sit there and use the natural filtration systems of it before that water finally escapes up out of there, and then by the time it gets out of there would be considered fresh water, which I still wouldn't drink it. It's just the thought of the thing. But anyway, there are ways, natural methods by which to filter the waste and water to get it back to where it's now safe to introduce into the environment. You know, if you go look at Florida's system, the growth rate and the septic systems that they've got out there and different types, that you'll notice that in those general areas, that's where you're going to find things like duckweed, watermill, and different types of green algae in the freshwater environment. Well, then when it rains, and the water that hasn't been fully treated makes it down into the waterways and basically flushes a highly nutrient-rich down there, that's where you get these big old red algae blooms. So this isn't just a Florida issue. It's a worldwide issue. People like to live by the beach, and so if they've got septic systems on their side, or maybe their sewage treatment plants aren't engineered properly to basically filter all that water before it's left back out into the environment, then that's what could potentially make what would have been a natural thing a little bit more to maybe even a lot more intense, and cause this fish kill off and stuff like that. But if we get a general understanding of how all this stuff is actually beginning, we know how nature's actually doing it, we can at the very least be able to resolve the issues that man produces, such as if the sugar farmers, if they had a moat type system around their land to catch any runoff before this runoff ever even made it downstream, catch any runoff and begin a filtration process just like you would be if you're doing a septic system. You understand how whenever you're flushing your toilet in your house and all this is going down into your system, your septic system, and then it's beginning to be treated so that it, by the time the water gets out the other end, it matches the EPA standards, and now it's considered to be fresh water and safe to release into the environment. And then understanding that there's certain chemistry that would counteract what you're trying to do with your septic system, such as antibacterial soaps, things like bleaches, chemicals that you shouldn't be flushing down your septic system, can throw your septic system out of balance, which then in turn will, basically be counteracted to the whole process of you trying to treat that water before it ever even gets back out into the environment. So where we're trying to, keep the germs off of us and that kind of stuff, there's good germs and there's bad germs, and in the process of trying to ensure we stay healthy, we use a lot of antibacterial soaps that then in turn, could be killing off good bacteria as well. This whole entire scenario, what we're talking about, and the reason why I brought up Dr. Lorraine Day's book that she wrote, and there's lots of videos out there. I posted a link to one of them so that that'll give you a starting point if you jump over to the super chat room, that you can look into what she's talking about. And when she's breaking down the body as a chemistry set, talking about why certain diseases happen when you throw your sugar off balance in your deal, and what happens when that happens, and so on down the line, it gives you an understanding of how your diet could be really seriously important to your health by keeping your chemistry in balance, because there's certain things that you eat that counteract other things that you eat or whatever. And so what she's saying and what I'm saying is one and the same. Nature has a chemistry going on, and if that chemistry is thrown out of balance, then you get these certain types of results, such as the red tide out there being more intense than it would have otherwise been naturally. So You don't have to take all the nutrients out of the water in order to try to kill off the red tide. What you need to do is find a happy medium balance between what the green algae working its way down the fresh water and going into the salt water, and the then being fed off by the other type of algae, which makes it thrive. By understanding these basic concepts of science and chemistry and nature and how they work, we can begin to control anything that would not be natural to the environment, such as we need to farm. We need to be able to grow certain crops or whatever, but in the process that we have to understand, you know, what our after effects are going to be of what we're actually doing. And the reason why I'm so adamant about this duckweed is because of several factors. Is one, duckweed can be used as a biofuel. Anything that's carbon-based could actually be used as a biofuel, for that matter. Grass clippings and all kinds of stuff can be turned into biofuel. But duckweed is also fish food. You can actually dehydrate it to make fish food flakes, and it makes a great fertilizer. So if you think about this in an economic basis, if the sugar company has to pay for fertilizers, which they get through different companies, but they had a fertilizer substitute, which would be the duckweed that you could actually use as fertilizer and compost and so on and so forth, you could take and with these moats, so to speak, that are surrounding these farmlands to catch the runoff, to actually give the water time to filter before it actually makes it into the environment. When the duckweed absorbs up the fertilizers from these farm fields, then you can skim off half of this duckweed every 24 48 hours. This stuff will double anyway, so you can skim off half of it, store that, use it as fertilizer for your deal, so you're actually going to be recycling fertilizer that was run off from the rain into this storage spot anyway. So you're getting to use your fertilizer twice, and then at a certain point you wouldn't even have to go out and buy new fertilizer, because as long as you are using this, it's putting nutrients into the system and then, you know, recycling it back around. See, nature recycles everything. There's nothing out there in nature that nature doesn't recycle. There's nothing that man has ever made that nature doesn't recycle. The aggravation that we get is that we got a beautiful pond and we want to keep this pond beautiful, and in the process we got a neighbor who's out there trying to feed the world by growing crops and, you know, earn a living and stuff, but he's over fertilizing his farmland, which in turn is affecting my pond, because it's now making it super highly nutrient rich, and any algae in there are going to thrive. And if you get any species that basically overgrown, then that's where you get a problem. And so, you know, if you don't have something there to compete with the green algae as far as pulling nutrients out of the water, then the green algae will grow too rapidly. If you don't have algae eaters that can come in there and eat the green algae, everything has to have a balance. There's nothing in this in the world that nature hasn't provided. There's all types of bugs, there's all types of animals, the whole cycle life issue where, you know, this bug eats this microbe and this bird eats this bug and so on. It's a food chain or whatever. But when you don't understand that and one of these things gets completely out of control, you got more of one than you got the other, then you end up with basically an eco disaster as far as we're concerned, because now my pond looks terrible and I can't grow fish in there because there's not enough oxygen available in there to grow fish because it's blocked out the sunlight, and now the ecosystem underneath the water is failing. And unless I've got enough fish in there to eat these duckweeds and water mills and, you know, things that eat the algaes, then it's going to continue to do the same thing, making the water more nutrients rich by killing off my fish and killing off anything under there. And, you know, the still water could actually become stagnated at some point in time. But if you actually look when this duckweed is actually doing its job and you skim back that water, you'll see that that water is crystal clear because that duckweed is filtering that water trying to put this this back into balance again. So it could be a plus. But if you understand this whole thing from start to finish, the farmers could actually benefit financially by not having to pay for fertilizer, by not having to pay near the fuel cost, because this actually can be turned into a biodiesel that can then in turn run their tractors to help them do the deal. And if the governments and the people wanted to ensure that these runoffs weren't being a part of the problem and affecting the waterways down the way, then they could, work some sort of deal out with them that, okay, you put these moats around your deal to catch the water runoff, to give that the time to clean up, and then, we'll give you supplements to, be able to take this, skim half of this off and use it as fertilizer and maybe even possible biodiesel or whatever, and put systems into place to actually do this. Like if you try to skim watermill or duckweed with just a net, it's a nightmare because you can't keep up with it. It grows so fast. But if you design a system that will actually skim off a portion of this watermill every day, a portion of it in these little areas, and the water really don't even have to be that deep. It can just be a small, moat around the system, and you allow this natural plant to do its filtration just like nature normally does, and then you have a system in place so that this stuff can't actually wash downstream and cause an overgrowth down there and just kind of domino down there, because eventually if it was not done properly, the plant itself could actually make it down there, and since it's a freshwater plant, it's obviously not going to be able to survive in a saltwater environment, so when the two mix, the plant will die off, and then therefore making the water yet even more nutrient-rich, because anything biological that dies is going to add nutrients to the water that will, the nature's cleaner, which is the algae itself, is going to come in there to get it, and little bacterias and stuff. Let me see if I can find this real quick here. See, function of algae. There it is, I think. Excuse me, folks. There's a deal down there from www.rdmag.com. Basically, it talks about scientists offer proof, first definitive proof of bacteria feeding behaviors. It also talks about algae. A team of researchers has captured images of green algae consuming bacteria, offering a glimpse at how early organisms dating back to more than a million years may have acquired free-living photosynthetic cells. That sounds high-tech terminology, but basically what is that everything has a purpose. The algae eating the bacteria, other algae's eating other algae's, everything's eating everything, and if anything gets overfed, then it gets overgrown, and then next thing you know, you got a natural disaster going on. So, using what Dr. Lorraine Day's talking about, diseases don't just happen, and being able to diagnose problems that are going on in the world, fish die-offs are obviously not a very nice thing. Nature's going to balance nature out no matter what, but our actions, whatever we do on shore, can affect the actions that are going on offshore. So if we've got highly nutrient-rich waterways and we have to ensure that we don't flood ourselves, some of that highly nutrient-rich water has to get released down there, otherwise we flood our homes or whatever. But if we pre-plan ahead, we can design our septic systems to be nature-friendly, so to speak. See, organisms that rely on need only light some algae only need light, carbon dioxide, and some other inorganic nutrients to grow. There are exceptions, of course, such as carnivorous plants that live on in low nutrient habitats. And here's a new one, microscopic algae that eat free-floating bacteria in the open ocean. So, when you're out to sea, and you think it's all okay, you just, you know, you got your really nice fishing boats and stuff like that, and you throw things overboard, and nature will come in there and they'll eat that stuff up, which is true. That's what's going on. So, you know, in the fishing community, some folks might even dump their septic tanks out of their ships into the ocean, which puts bacteria into the ocean, which then in turn can feed the red tide as well. So, if you understand that you're going to feed something, and you take precautions not to feed something, then it's not going to grow out of control. If you understand that even biological waste that humans produce, such as in your septic tank, trying to say this without sounding disgusting, but even that can be recycled into biofuels, methane and stuff like that, you know. If you get to the point where you understand how all this is going and what a release of this is actually going to do to the environment itself, but there's a plus that you, instead of dumping it out into the ocean to get rid of it, then you might carry it all the way to the shore, put it into a treatment facility plant, turn it into a useful product, such as methane gas and such that you could actually use to run your ships. So, if the governments decided they wanted to, you could actually make it a benefit for people to bring their waste into a treatment facility plan that was designed to make a certain type of, gas or even fertilizer that would, give them the incentive to, instead of dumping it out to sea, bring it in, have it recycled, and make something for that. They, maybe they get a discount on their fuel when they go to buy fuel for the ships to go out to sea again. So there is a, where there's a will, there's a way. There's a definite solution to every single problem that we're talking about here. The water mill, there's fish out there that will eat this stuff. So if you're into things like aquaponics, hydroponics and stuff like that, where you're actually growing fish and vegetables at the same exact time, this entire deal would work for you well, because you can use watermill and duckweed to feed the fish. When the fish do their business in the water, that makes the nutrients in the water that is then in turn recycled up through the system that actually feeds the duckweed and watermill to promote its growth, and in turn filters the water back out and brings it back around so that your fish stay healthy. So you can grow fish and you can grow plants, and you can do it in a self-looping system, understanding the basics of how nature's actually functioning. So, you can turn a negative into a positive. And I wrote a letter to, Governor Rick Scott of Florida, hopefully, that I would get a response. But, well, I guess we'll find out pretty soon, or maybe I won't find out, because I'm going to play a little portion of this podcast again, but either way, I posted in the chat rooms the information that I sent down to the governor of Florida for their particular issue down there, and basically I was trying to explain to them a potential solution to use, I'll just read this little section again. Duckweed also functions as a bioremediator. I gotta learn how to read. By effectively filtering contaminants such as bacteria, nitrogen, phosphates, and other nutrients from naturally occurring bodies of water, constructed wetlands, and wastewater. Basically used as a buffer between the sugar fields and Lake Okeechobee, this plant will filter the extra nutrients and contaminants. The green algae has nothing at this point to compete with it. So basically it's growing out of control, and that's what's causing the problem. So I'm going to play this other next podcast right here for a second, and I'll get back with you.
For weeks now, thousands of dead fish, turtles, manatees, and dolphins have been washing up on beaches in southwest Florida. The culprit, Carinia brevis, a small toxic algae undergoing a massive bloom. It literally turns the waters red. It's the worst so-called red tide the area has seen in over a decade, and experts say it's far from over. The question on everyone's minds, though, is why is it so bad this year, and if this is a warning of things to come. Algal blooms are exactly what they sound like, the rapid, massive proliferation of algae. They're a natural part of many ecosystems, but they can also happen unnaturally in polluted waters because our waste fertilizes the bloom. Extreme algal blooms often spell trouble for aquatic life, but Floridian red tides can be especially devastating. Like other blooms, the sudden overabundance of these tiny single-celled algae can kill fish and other creatures. That's because when the algae die, they're eaten by certain bacteria that can use up the oxygen in the water, leaving little left over for other species to breathe. They can also suffocate fish and other animals by directly clogging their gills. But Florida's red tides are even more deadly because the algae responsible also produce potent neurotoxins called brevetoxins. These toxins open sodium channels in cells, causing muscles to clench inappropriately and messing with the immune system. When fish or shellfish consume the algae, intentionally or not, they get loaded with these toxins. Obviously, that's not good for them, but it's also not good for us, because even if the fish survive, they become dangerous to eat, which we like to do. The toxins are tasteless, odorless, and resistant to heat and acids, so you can't easily tell if your food is contaminated, and normal cooking procedures don't get rid of them. That's why during bad blooms like this, the government usually puts a moratorium on local shellfish. Eating contaminated seafood isn't the only way these algal blooms harm people either. Brevetoxins also have the rare ability to aerosolize. Wave action near the surface breaks apart the fragile algae, releasing their toxins into the air. When breathed in, these toxins can irritate your respiratory system, causing your eyes, nose, and throat to sting and burn, and inducing coughing and wheezing. I used to live in Florida. This has happened to me before. It's not comfortable. It's like somebody sprayed mace nearby. People with respiratory conditions like asthma are especially vulnerable, and while no human deaths have been attributed to red tides, the effects can send people to the ER. Thankfully, symptoms are usually temporary and resolve quickly once you get away from the shore, but they're not fun. And unfortunately, marine mammals and turtles can't escape the toxic air or the toxins in their food. This year, it's estimated that the red tide has killed several hundred turtles, dozens of manatees, and thousands upon thousands of fish, as well as dolphins, birds, and one poor whale shark. The die-offs are especially heartbreaking, as many hard-hit species, like the sea turtles, are already endangered. And I mean, manatees were just moved from endangered to threatened last year. This year's red tide is an especially awful one, with more than 160 kilometers of southwest Florida coastline already affected, and scientists are still trying to understand why it's so bad. Red tides occur just about every year now, and there are records of them dating back centuries, so it's not like these things are new. They start between 15 and 65 kilometers offshore in late summer or early fall.
I gotta pause that for a second. He just said that scientists are still trying to figure out why this is so bad. It's ridiculousness, folks, I'm telling you. I just sat there and explained to you why it's actually so bad and why it can actually be amplified by, you know, different things that, you know, occur. Even fishing industry out there in the, you know, basically the fun industry where you're out there going on your boating and doing all the things that you normally do, and, you know, farming industry, all these different things, complex things interacting with each other and basically adding food and fuel to the fire. It's that simple. I can't understand why anybody would even remotely say that scientists can't figure out why it's so bad. I can tell you exactly why it's so bad. Follow the thing to its source and you'll figure it out.
fall, and sometimes stay entirely offshore. Usually they only last a few months. But this bloom started over 9 months ago and shows no signs of slowing down. There have been blooms in the past that have lasted years, so the duration isn't unprecedented. But exactly what triggers the algae to flourish and why some blooms last while others don't is still largely a mystery. There's a lot of internet speculation that particularly polluted waters from Florida's Lake Okeechobee, which were released down a river this summer, are to blame for this year's red tide. But experts are quick to point out that the tide began before those waters were released and far from where the river meets the sea. In fact, studies have largely failed to find connections between land-based pollution and the frequency of red tides. The tides seem to start too far offshore for runoff to be a major factor, so sorry, internet. Things like the Lake Okeechobee water could be fueling the bloom now that it's close to shore, though.
And another thing that's kind of aggravating was what he's just talking about there about the, you know, how the internet, the people on the internet's all kind of worried about how this is actually occurring. It's a factor, it's all these things in conjunction with each other that's actually amplifying the situation. And so the people out there concerned about the fish die-offs, they're not mistaken in their thoughts of how this is actually happening. Basically, you're amplifying something that would occur naturally in nature, and it's not just a Florida thing. It's the whole Gulf Coast over there, whatever's going on the other side of the ocean side of that part over there, whatever pollutants they might be adding to the situation would basically amplify the entire deal. Even though this is something that would be a natural occurrence, you know, throughout history of time, it can be amplified and is amplified by, you know, things like leaky septic systems and, over-fertilization of land and such. So, you know, for these folks to try to say, well, no, it's not this, you know, yeah, it is this and that, both. So let's finish this up here.
Giving it all kinds of extra nutrients, which might help explain why it's still going. But even then, there are tons of other factors at play. Warmer waters from climate change might be increasing this year's severity as these and other algae seem.
And then you go into the climate change, which throws another monkey wrench into the situation. These folks, I tell you, man, it's just aggravating as heck. And wonder why I call it mad science. Climate change, carbon emissions, and all that kind of craziness, and it boggles my mind. You know, these folks are supposedly, scientists, or even, you know, well studied in science, and they just can't get the basics down. It drives me insane. But it ain't got nothing to do with climate change, that's for sure.
To like things hot, and it's possible that last year's notorious hurricane season also contributed to the current state of things, as hurricanes in the past have dragged nutrients offshore to fuel blooms. Scientists studying this year's red tide won't really have answers until they analyze the data they're collecting and compare what's happening now to previous years, but they expect the bloom to continue for a while, maybe even into next year. That means dead animals will continue to litter beaches where the bloom is worst, and local businesses already feeling lost tourism revenue will continue to struggle. So far, researchers haven't found a great way to get rid of or control red tides, since it would require getting both the algae and the resulting brevetoxins out of the water. So the most we can do right now is hope that it ends quickly for everybody's sake, and study it while it's happening. If you want to keep up to date with how things are going in Florida, you can follow the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's regular updates, or NOAA's harmful algal bloom warnings and forecasts. And the site visitbeaches.org, which is run by Moat Marine Laboratory, has updated conditions for popular tourist hotspots. Links are in the description. Thanks for watching this episode of SciShow News, and a special thank you to our longest-running president of space, S.R. Foxley. Thanks, S.R. If you want to help keep SciShow free and accessible to everybody who wants it, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/scishow to learn more.
President of space. Didn't even know there was a president of space. We can't even keep control of what we got going on down here, and you talk about want to go out into space and make a mess out of that place too, huh? Alright, look. The simple of this whole deal is that when you see these doggone algae blooms out there, if you really wanted to control it and you really wanted to turn it in from a negative to a positive, there are methods by which you could actually turn these algae into biofuel, you know. Turn this what would have been a negative into a positive, at the very least, not completely eradicate what nature's provided to clean up the mess, but to utilize and contain. When you see this bloom coming in, you could basically surround a doggone thing, siphon it up out of the water, separate it from the water itself, and then turn it into something useful, and basically move it out of the environment, which would... Because here's the thing, one of the ladies on the second podcast I played, I believe, was talking about how during the nighttime this algae can actually go down to the bottom where all the nutrients is and the safer place for it to be, and then during the daytime it comes back up to the top. Well, duckweed will do the same thing in the summertime when duckweed's growing wild. It'll actually be all over the top, and then during the winter time, it'll actually float down to the bottom, down in the bottom of your pond, and it looks like it's all gone, but then when summer comes back, it's right back again. And if you got the same aggravating situation going on, such as the farmers over-fertilizing their crops, well, then that runoff's going to come down there, and year after year, this duckweed and water mill is going to continue to get completely out of hand. If you don't have no duckweed and water mill in there, then the only thing that would be in that pond would be really high concentrates of algae. And so, let's see, what method has the world always used to power it? Throw me a bone in there. What are you talking about there, Justin? So, basically, if we wanted to resolve this issue, then we actually have to start working side by side with nature, doing what nature does. In Florida, where they have the sugar farms at, and if they want to not to add to the red tide, then they want to ensure that the runoff doesn't get into Lake Okeechobee to begin with, the highly nutrients rich, and they want to ensure that people who are out there using Lake Okeechobee aren't dumping their commodes over into the water, which throws bacteria in there, which then in turn has the algae to come in there to try to combat. And when, you know, certain things like bacteria get overrun, then also there's going to be a heck of a food source for algae to come in there to try to compensate. See, right angles and V's in the... What are you talking about? So anyway, if you get your chemistry out of whack, that's when all these different types of algae will turn your lakes green and, you know, not make it very... pleasant to look at. So, anyway, I'm sorry, I got distracted there for a second. So, let's see. Let's see, where was I? I think I already read that. The role of algae. There's another deal for a link to sciencing.com that talks about identification of algae. Algae is a large, diverse group of photosynthetic organisms have the ability to convert sunlight to food and energy. Algae are not considered plants. So, there's a lot to learn about the terminology of all this kind of stuff, but either way, I'll throw this link up in there too so that you can... check it out if you like it out there at the super chat room. Alright. Let me see what's going on here. This is terrible for live radio. Anyway, go check out that book that Dr. Lorraine Day wrote called Diseases Don't Just Happen. And factor in what I'm talking about here today. Basically, when you're looking at a big, massive fish die off, there's a symptom, there's a cause and effect. And a lot of these folks out here that say that scientists haven't figured out why it's so bad this year is because they're not following it back to the initial source. And why are you doing that? Anyway, they don't follow it back to the initial source of what's actually going on. And so, basically, something that would have been natural has now been, you know, amplified by other factors that play in. When we're trying to, go through our daily life, there's machinery that we use that use what they call fossil fuels and crude oils and different types of oils, and you got to actually follow it back to where all of these actually came from. That when they get into the environment, while they might have an immediate reaction to environment, such as killing off some plant life, they also get absorbed back into the system, and then in turn, turn that ground that you just polluted initially from the initial reaction of the mixing the oils with the soil and the plants can't grow in it, to turning that then in turn into nutrients that the next time around the doggone plants will grow wild in there. See, there's nothing that mankind has ever made that nature can't reabsorb. So when you get that down, then you'll understand that there's a actual solution to the problem, and you can, at the very least, reduce what man has actually done to add to the problem. So as far as what entire nation? How you doing, Ted?
I'm doing good, Shaziz. I was worried about you. I didn't see you online. I thought you weren't doing the show today.
Yeah, we're live right now.
Oh, good.
So that means you weren't listening in?
I'll download it later on when I get the bandwidth to do that, so I can't stream very well, but I can download, no problem.
All right, well, let me catch you up to speed here. Basically, started off talking about red tide and the solution to red tide. There's a situation going on in Florida that's causing fish die-off and so on. Well, basically just broke it down to... There's a lady out there called Dr. Lorraine Day. She wrote a book called Diseases Don't Just Happen, wherein she explains the chemistry of the body and why it is that, the body basically gets sick, because the body's a chemistry set. The earth is a chemistry set. And when you throw either one of those chemistries out of balance, nature has things to put into place to bring it back into balance. So the red algae has a purpose, the green algae has a purpose, everything has a purpose. And if you have highly nutrient rich water, then these types of algae can actually thrive. And the algae can actually eat bacteria. So if you got leaky septic systems, or if you got people dumping their commodes from their boats down into the water system, it's throwing that chemistry out of balance. And then they back further to where most of the people are believing that it's actually occurring is from the sugar farmers that are they're fertilizing their crops with things like anhydrous ammonia and different types of fertilizers, and when it rains, that water then in turn runs off into the waterways, which then in turn makes that water highly nutrient rich, then flows down into Lake Okeechobee, which then in turn makes it nutrient rich. And any algae that would be naturally occurring in there can now thrive to the extent where they become overpopulated and produce this, nasty-looking green effect to the water. And so following that, when it rains too much and they have to release some of the water from Lake Okeechobee to ensure that there ain't flooding around, they then in turn release that water, which is still highly nutrient rich, down into the waterways, that then in turn makes it from a freshwater down into the salt water. So if you have green algae that is thriving because of highly nutrient-rich water, and that is going down into mixing with salt water. If you've ever been to places like Florida or California that you have freshwater streams mixing with saltwater streams, you'll notice that there's a color change right there in that area, and that's because there's certain plants that can't live in salt water that can live in fresh water. And so when that plant hits the salt water portion of it and that starts to mix, it causes that plant to die off, which then in turn adds more nutrients to the water that in turn allows the red bacteria to, or red algae to be able to thrive, and you end up with a bloom. And so this isn't something just Florida related or California related. This is basically worldwide related. You know, red algae have been around since before the industrial age, and so there, you know, have been, you know, documented episodes where people had noticed this and fish die-offs and stuff, and it took years for them to figure out what the cause was. We're just amplifying something that already was a natural process, because all the algaes out there are basically nature's little cleanup machines. You know, algaes, bacterias, duckweeds, water mills, they're all, you know, there to begin the process of nature filtering out things that don't belong, that are throwing the chemistry out of balance, if you understand what I'm saying. So, inadvertently, the farmer that lives next to me is fertilizing his land, and he's using anhydrous ammonia to add nitrogen and other things to the soil. He's using different types of fertilizers and maybe even pesticides, and in the process of doing that, he grows a real good healthy crop. But then when it rains, some of that nutrients in the soil then in turn washes off of his farm field down into my pond. When it gets into my pond, it raises the nutrients level and the nitrogen and phosphates and all that up to such a high extent that any algae that is already in existence, that's already naturally in my pond, now can grow rapidly. When that gets to that extent, that rapid growth would cause that algae to be able to cover the entire surface of the pond. So duckweed, watermill, and types of algae can grow rapidly in this circumstance. And then when that sunlight can't get through to the bottom of my pond, then that causes the ecosystem underneath that to start to break down. And then you end up with the domino effect. It as these algae are either dying off or, you know, doing what they're doing, they're causing the oxygen to change in the pond, and then in turn causes the fish to die, which then adds even more nutrients to the pond, which promotes yet even more growth, and so that pond is completely out of balance. But even in this process, there's still a plus. Nature has put in place these filtration systems, such as the duckweed and the watermill and other algaes, to balance that system back out. So if you actually go to a pond that is completely covered with green algaes, duckweeds, and watermill, and you skim back the water, you'll notice that the water underneath that is crystal clear, because nature's doing its job. And after a certain point, if you start introducing fish that basically are a predator to duckweed and different types of algaes and stuff like that, there are natural fish that eat these things. And so you can get a balance back to that pond by understanding how nature actually does it, the food chain, so to speak. So like perch, you know, in my area, a little perch will eat duckweed. And so if there's enough perch in that pond, they'll keep enough of that duckweed off to keep enough sunlight going through that pond to allow the ecosystem underneath it to actually get sunlight for the photosynthesis to occur and produce oxygen and do all the things that nature naturally does. And there are other types of fish out there as well, goldfish and koi and grass carp that can be introduced in these particular ponds and stuff that will eat this. There are freshwater algae eaters. There are saltwater algae eaters. All of these things could be introduced into this equation in order to start the process from what actually occurred from what the farmer did. down to the process of filtration to bringing it back into where it's now safe to release this water back into nature according to EPA standards or whatever. But in the whole concept of what I just explained here, then the farmer doesn't actually have to stop doing what he's doing, just needs to be able to do it a little wiser than what he's doing, and so it won't be adding to the problem. For example, what I was talking about, the duckweed, you don't even have to bring duckweed from my state to Florida because it's already natural in Florida. There's already a species of duckweed that actually filters the water, pulls out nutrients and contaminants and stuff like that. Well, let's say this year, the farmer does everything that he normally does, with exception is now he's got a moat around his, any place where the water is going to run off that pond, and you introduce this duckweed into there. Now, anytime it rains and the water comes down there and, makes that water now super highly nutrient-rich, and it has some sort of system so that this stuff, the duckweed can't flow downstream, but it's there to filter that water. Then, every 24 to 48 hours, this stuff will double in size, and you can actually skim off half of it, turn around and reuse that duckweed as fertilizer for your crop. And so now you don't have to use as much fertilizer as you did before. You're actually recycling fertilizer that you used prior, if you understand what I said, because the runoff went into the pond, the duckweed absorbed up all this nutrients, and now you have a highly nutrient-rich plant that can be used as fertilizer. It can also be turned into biodiesels. It can be turned into, you can dehydrate it, make fish food flakes and stuff. As long as you're not putting like pesticides or herbicides onto your cropland, then these plants would actually be safe to reuse for, like feeding wildlife or, your chickens or your ducks or whatever. So by not doing certain things that they used to do and, still fertilizing, and then the next time around actually using a portion of what they just generated as far as the duckweed, watermill, and algaes to actually turn into biofuel, biodiesels for their tractors, fertilizers for their farm, for the crop, and, fish food for their wildlife or whatever it is they're growing. So, does any of that make any sense to you so far?
Absolutely.
Well,
I got an aquaponic system, so I understand that thoroughly.
Yeah. Well, explain to people how your aquaponic system actually benefits, where you can do multiple tasks just in one situation there.
Well, first of all, I believe that that's a little off topic, but I kind of believe that the aquaponics, if you use the beds that flood and drain with a medium in them, like gravel or rock or something in there, pebbles, pellets, and then that water floods and drains every few minutes in there, fills up, drains. I believe that bacteria that lives underneath there at the lower levels actually does transmutation of elements. Because after running some tests and seeing how there's fish, so in the aquaponics system, there's fish in a tank, and the water moves over into the grow beds and then back into the fish. And the fish provide the nutrients for the plants pull out the extra nutrients so the fish can have clean water, and it's like a symbiotic ecosystem. It's great for places that don't have a lot of electricity or not a lot of fresh water, where it's hard to do hydroponic growing because there's just not enough water to keep draining. After your chemical solutions get out of control, you have to flush your system and start fresh. Well, aquaponics, you don't have to do that because you maintain the ecosystem within that. And so,
it's basically self-looping like nature. It's using everything in nature.
Yeah, it's a self-loop, self-cleaning loop.
Well, and that's a plus, and that's what I'm trying to get at. People that understand aquaponic systems could be really beneficial to actually going to places like Florida and showing these people how they could actually utilize what would have normally been a negative for a positive.
See, well, that's what I was thinking in my mind, is that really what you're seeing there, it's kind of like the gasoline engine. I mean, the only reason that there's, you know, nastiness coming out your exhaust pipe is because it's not a complete burn.
Yeah.
And it's like the same with their ways of farming. They don't use all of their nutrients. They just put so much down to get their results and then let it wash away and then put next year put the same amount down to get better results or whatever. And it's like, well, you know, they say it all flows downhill, you know, or downstream or whatever the old saying is.
Yeah,
it's like that's
the
exactly
process,
what's happening.
The process that
and
we... The process
really
that we just...
evidence of their inefficiency. Because if they were efficient with their... with their fertilizers and stuff, it would potentially not make it down there. You know, they could keep it self-looping on their farm. I see where you're going with that.
You know, the process that we just explained, though, basically would give them the option to grow their own fertilizer, where they wouldn't have to go out and buy fertilizer. And
exactly.
the same thing would also give them the option to turn some of this growth into biodiesel that they could turn... run, you know, in conjunction with their diesel engine or their normal diesel that they use, and actually save on fuel costs. So it's a win-win for them, you know. And not only are they resolving the problem that would be going downstream that would cause all this political arguing back and forth about who's to blame or what to do about it, they could actually turn it into a plus. Well, you know, in the carbon portion, they're trying to make factories be able to recapture carbon and break down their carbon emission, you know, building all kinds of innovative filtration systems and such. So why not in the farming industry? You know, if the people in the industry that use carbon or whatever, if they understood that their waste products could actually be beneficial towards reducing their energy cost as well, then they would want to do that also. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean, but I feel like with the carbon, I mean, by introducing those regulations, they know that those companies can hold up and they can suck that money out of those corporations. Because they have such a stranglehold on energy and things like that.
Well,
but with the farmers, even if you had a system that would stop all this tomorrow,
you wouldn't
force it into regulation and implement it, because you wouldn't be able to, you know, rape off the farmers and pillage them, because they don't have any money anyway.
Well,
farmers are already they're already so borderline that I don't think that the people that would be able to solve this problem, like carbon sequestering, they don't want to solve this problem because they can't exploit the farmers. There's not enough money there.
I don't advocate going out with more regulations. What I advocate is people understanding how we could actually help the farmers to resolve this issue and benefit everybody at the same point. Like, for example, what I said earlier was that if there were, you know, methods by which, like, these people that go out to sea with their fishing boats, all right, they get way out to sea. Some of them may do it, some of them may not do it. Some of them may dump their septic systems over, or they might even dump waste from the fish overboard, and that adds extra nutrients that if was combined with a algae bloom would aggravate the system by giving it more nutrients. But if they had some sort of deal where the government would say, okay, well, if you bring all this biological waste in and you bring it to this one particular plant, we'll give you a discount on other, when you go, your fuel costs. We'll help you out on your fuel costs just so that you don't pollute out to sea, and this will actually save you money benefiting your business. And so then when it goes to this facility where you're now taking this waste product and you're turning it into different types of, gases like methane or biodiesels or whatever, you're actually reducing the need to go out and, you know, get more oil or whatever. You see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So there's all kinds of solutions, and if people really want to try to, pay attention to what, nature's been saying, That's the reason why I brought Dr. Lorraine Day up about her book, Diseases Don't Just Happen, because she explains it. She breaks it down into, you know, the body being a chemistry set. And then if you actually go out there and look at, you know, different types of researches such as like oxygen therapies and stuff, 90% of all the diseases out there occur because of oxygen deprivation, because certain body, you know, problems will, like if you get a mass start to grow and it's pushing on a vital organ and it's keeping the blood flow from getting to that vital organ. Now, it went from this mass to now you got a kidney problem or a liver problem. Your body can't filter it, can't get the circulation it needs. It's not getting the oxygen into the bloodstream and the plasma in order to be able to stimulate the stem cells that, you know, help to build new blood cells and to get down into the soft tissues, which in turn promote cell growth to heal wounds and such. So when you understand it like that, now you know that you can bring that chemistry back into, you know, with you know, just a little bit of basic knowledge. There's so many things that could be healed with just oxygen therapy alone. There, if you understand body's chemistry, if you understand how nature is a chemistry set, and things that we do, such as over-fertilizing our farmlands, is going to have a cause and effect thing. The runoff's going down into the next waterway that's going to throw that out of balance, which then in turn, when it gets out of balance and things start dying off in that, like the wildlife underneath that green slime or water mill, then in turn turns that water so super highly nutrient rich, and then when that runoff goes down to the next one, it's a domino effect all the way out to the ocean that meets the red tide. You see what I mean?
I absolutely do, and I think that, you know, even on a spiritual level, I mean, the red tide, you know, it's like our farming and agriculture system is so backwards and broken, this is what's going to happen. I mean, you know, you can't just force, you know, all of the farming and, you know, push everything down the Mississippi River and hope everything's going to be just fine and dandy, you know what I'm saying? You just can't. You can't do this style of farming. Like, when you go, I've gotten the luxury of traveling around other countries to understand their food and their food systems. And it doesn't matter if you're in Italy or Ecuador, they have a market, and that's where everybody gets their food. It doesn't matter if they're super first world or poor as can be. Their farmers in their region provide their food and they go to the market. So far as I know, the United States might be the only country that really operates food like this, where we ship food from thousands of miles around our own country to move it around to places, because just in my research, it just doesn't happen that way. And I think that, well, when you put those kind of strains on a small area, and like you're going to say, like, we're going to grow like millions of pounds of pork in this area for like half the country in this one town or in a few mile radius, make this like the pork triangle and have, you know, and it's going to be nasty. It's like we have a few areas like that where chickens, they're like Purdue and Tyson, now IBP chicken factories. And like, you know, you put that many chickens in a warehouse and put that many warehouses together, you know, you can't go within 15 miles of this area. It's nasty. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And it really, if the EPA came down and understood, like, what is in this gas that is in chicken food? But like, that's some powerful stuff. You know, when I raise chicken, you don't go in there without a little mask or something, go tear up the, you don't mix up the chicken poop and the hay and the silage and like breathe all that in. You open up all the doors, put a little something over your face, and then go in there and try not to breathe much. And, cause you can get real sick from breathing in chicken poop that's airborne.
Well, sure.
And so,
but the whole,
you know, interesting.
The whole thing is, everything you just explained about the, you know, the pig industry, the chicken industry, and all that kind of stuff, is they're able to grow a lot of food, but the problem is the waste products that they're producing, it's got to go somewhere. And if they're not, you know, doing like what I explained here, there's a method by which we can actually assist the farmer and benefit the environment at the same time. Whereas even at the chicken factories, the same processes could be actually used to benefit those as well. See, we're going out, we're getting all these fossil fuels from overseas and stuff like that, when in reality, our farming communities are producing more than enough, fuels for, we could be totally 100% self-contained using what they would classify as fossil fuels, which is a complete and utter misnomer. It doesn't have no basis in real science at all, but nonetheless...
On renewable resources, no?
Yeah, but if you used all the waste from every single industry out there and you utilized it properly, there wouldn't be no things that we would be talking about right now, massive die-offs that are assisted by, what man's doing. Now, nature will do what nature does. If there's a hurricane somewhere and it washes a bunch of highly nutrient-rich soils off somebody's farmland and out to sea, and that mixes with the salt water, then nature has a way of cleaning it up. And then people call it the red tide or whatever the scientific name for the algae is, or even bacteria for that matter. So, by whatever we do on here, if we made a backup plan, we could at the very least assist nature into not amplifying something that nature would have done naturally to resolve an issue. These algae are natural. Go ahead.
They are very natural. This brings me back to the body and digestion, and how we don't really consume most of the food that we eat. It comes out on the other end.
Yeah.
As waste. And we take through, acid and base chemistry, but I don't know what that process is, titration or something. We dissolve out elements and we call them minerals. To eat, we have to get our minerals. You gotta get your minerals.
Yeah.
You gotta eat your peas, get your minerals. Well, what does that mean? You gotta get your elements. And it's like the same with the plants. It's like the plants only need so many elements to live or to be healthy. But we pump so much in to make available for them that they can just have more than they need. You see what I'm saying? And
yeah.
Then there's a problem. Like if the humans or the animals had the energy that they needed from the minerals that they needed, they wouldn't need to pump so much in and have so much extra. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well,
and that's the thing about food. Like when you eat good quality food, you don't have to pump so much in. If you eat lower quality food, you seem you're hungry all the time. Well, you're depleted in minerals, but you have plenty of energy. You have plenty of nitrogen, like a plant. And that's exactly what they do. They give the plants junk food, just straight nitrogen, and then, they grow, like they fatten up, and then they harvest them. Well, when they do that, they pump so much nitrogen, and that's what they cause, is problems. And it's like same with the human body. It's like, you pump in a bunch of junk food and carbs and stuff, and it's so hot, it's gonna burn up your internal system.
Well, the sugar.
And you're not even gonna get all that you could. The plant isn't gonna be as healthy as if in a nitrogen-rich environment, only if it was in, like, say, some real good humic organic soil. It's gonna have different qualities. The fruit's gonna taste different. The flowers are gonna look a little different. The nitrogen one's still gonna grow real fat. But it's gonna be a different composition. And that's the same with our body. And like why we have to eat like good quality food from good quality soil is so that we get those nutrients, those minerals, those elements, that atomic energy that runs our body.
That's why books like what Dr. Lorraine Day put together about diseases don't just happen, and what we've been explaining here today about, cause and effect of, adding too much nutrients to the soil and the runoff and how all this stuff functions. All these things together, what she said and what we're saying is identical. You're throwing the chemistry out of balance. We have every single answer to resolve every single problem just by using common sense and understanding that, we can build the perfect machines that we can still get the work done that we need done. We can still have the fun we want with our, toys and stuff. We can still have the internet and all the technologies if we just do these things responsibly wherever our industries are, whether they be on our land or foreign lands, that they put in place systems that will ensure that you don't throw the ecology, the ecosystem downstream out of balance by what you're doing. And that's why I thought the Environmental Protection Agency was there to try to do, but you know, apparently they're not doing a very good job because they don't have the simple understanding of what is the cause and what is the effect of what you're actually doing enough to go to explain to them. Instead of just throwing regulations on people, they should throw things out there that would give them the incentive and the understanding to say, look, you're producing this particular waste. Did you know that this particular waste could actually supplement your fuel cost? It could actually supplement your energy cost? Or it could actually help to be food for your cattle? Like the duckweed and the water mill that I'm talking about, while it's filtering out natural nutrients, it's actually building, you know, highly protein and nutrient-rich plant that you could then in turn, like the pig factory. Have you ever been around a pig farm? It stinks. There's a lot of methane going on. But if you took and understood how to utilize that waste product, you could actually turn the waste product into fuel for your generators, and you could also turn it into nutrients for growing duckweed, which then in turn could be turned around and fed to your cattle. You see what I'm saying? Just by understanding how the steps of nature function, you could feed your cattle for a fraction of the price. And they'd be healthy because they, you know, it's already been filtered naturally. It's now turned what would have been waste into an actual food source, just like the aquaponic system you explained. What do you think?
Well, I agree completely. And I look at it like if you were to take a big old chunk of, say you need calcium. People say they need calcium. You got to drink your milk. You got to get your calcium. It's like, well, if you just eat a chunk of calcium, like if you buy off the internet like a sample of calcium and like grind it up and eat it, you're not going to, and it's just like chunks, like rocks, you're not really going to get much calcium from that. You are. You're going to digest some of it. But the point is, you're going to poop most of it out. And that's the same thing that's going on in the soil, is that, you know, they're pumping in that really fine nitrogen. So it's already available, and then it just washes through. And it's because they don't have any bacteria in their soil to do it naturally. Because to grow bacteria in soil, because see, people don't really grow plants. Soil grows plants, in my mind. And so the way that people grow plants is we take care of the soil, and then we put whatever plant we want in there, and it grows. And so when we use bacteria and, you know, what people want to call organic practices in the soil to make nutrients, it releases them very slowly, and it releases them in a natural way.
Yeah.
That if you have 100 acres of this kind of soil, down the stream, the water is going to be beautiful. Because this kind of soil doesn't have extra bioavailable nutrients. It makes it as it needs it. The bacteria communicates with the roots, and the roots let it know. They got science to prove it.
Well,
the roots is telling
said,
the bacteria what it needs.
You just
and the
said
bacteria
something
goes
that,
into a process.
You just said something that could be a key solution to resolving the issue to where they wouldn't even have to fertilize their land. For example, if you understand from like where your land is, where the water runs, if you get out there and you study from like the top of the hill down to the bottom on the terraces and all that, where your actual flow of water, when it rains, the water goes this way. You could actually put compost heaps up at the very top where the water starts, and then when it does rain, that runoff from that compost heap would come down and put nutrients in the soil and basically fertilize your crop without ever even having to do anything other than to take all your grass clippings and put them at the top of the hill. You see how simple that is?
It's unbelievably simple. When I first started my compost piles, I bring hundreds of pounds from restaurants and stuff, all kinds of silage, hay, and leaves, and started these mounds, and I was doing it at the bottom, you know, down by my stream, and I saw what was going on. I was, by making organic compost, I was polluting the water.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not correct at all. And so I was like, you know, this organic compost pile needs to go somewhere where that residual, that runoff is going into my plants.
There you go.
That's
See
what
how
you're
simple
saying.
That is?
Then you have your compost, you know, You got so much more out of that. You get, then you can always go take that compost and move it around, but when it rains, you know, you got to consider that. I mean, that's something that I think that they have to think about, that kind of stuff in farming these days, like with the commercial, like big production, but they only think about like the maximum levels. Like, well, if it's any more than this and somebody comes and inspects, we could get in trouble. And it's like, well, that's not what we're saying. Well, we're saying, let's use this, and then whatever's left over, if there's any, if we see residual, well, we need another capture unit. It's like, why are we wasting this nitrogen? We need this to be going somewhere. And, you know, once farmers can start to see, like, well, with carbon capturing, I don't know what you're going to do when you capture a bunch of carbon. It's a dime a dozen.
Yeah, we can turn around and use that captured carbon to help in the process of fertilization, because that's basically what's going on when nature breaks it down. But here's the thing.
Think about the captured carbon. Go ahead, man.
These farmers are, they're directly fertilizing right on top of the crop, all right? When they bring anhydrous ammonia in there and they inject it into the soil to put nitrogen into the soil and stuff like that, you know, they're putting it right directly onto the crop. Well, there it is. It's sitting there on the crop. And then when it rains, all that extra nutrients is going to make it off the crop and down the way, and then they got to come in and they got to put more down if they want more fertilizer on or not. But if you actually looked at it like we just explained, by putting it prior to where you know where the runoff is starting on your property, you know where you want it to go, you can guide it using terraces down into your crop and not even have to fertilize like you would be. And I don't know if a lot of people realize this, but anhydrous ammonia is used for a lot of different things, some nefarious things, such as people will use anhydrous ammonia to actually produce methamphetamines. And so there's actually, you know, people that will go out there and steal this from the farmer, which is highly dangerous because this stuff will tear you up if you get it on your skin or in your lungs. But either way, they'll go out there and they'll get buckets of this stuff or gas cans full of it, and then they will take it and use it in the process to make methamphetamines, which, you know, if you never had the anhydrous ammonia on the doggone property to begin with because you didn't need it, then you wouldn't have that downstream, if you understand what I'm saying. So
wait a second. If I'm to understand you correctly, you're saying there's people that are taking residual anhydrous ammonia and making meth out of it?
Yeah, they go and take, that's one of the ways where they actually take the ephedrine out of the different types of drugs that they use to, they use the anhydrous ammonia to do the chemical reaction to get it out. So they will go to these big, huge anhydrous tanks, and they will drain off anhydrous, and then they'll mix it with the other chemistry necessary to make the methamphetamines. And there you go. So if the farmers never even had the anhydrous ammonia to begin with, because they don't need it, in order to add nitrogen to the soil.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the anhydrous ammonia. That anhydrous ammonia is probably the number one reason that there's a red tide in Florida.
Yeah. They don't need it.
I mean, if you were to blame one product in general and say what did it, like, it would be, I mean, in my mind, studying agriculture, that would be the result of anhydrous ammonia.
You can get all the nitrogen necessary from things like burning firewood, you know. Like, there's a lot of people that will go out and they will burn off their field, all right? Well, and instead of doing anything else to that field, they'll burn it off and they'll leave all the ash set right there because it adds nitrogen to the soil. It makes the soil richer. And even in the industries where, you know, they're going out there taking care of it, where they're talking about starting intentional forest fires, there's a reason why they do that, because it adds stuff to the soil that now promotes, you know, really good healthy growth in that area instead of overgrowth.
So my view of agriculture is kind of like with the meaning of the nitrogen, is that anybody that's raising plants or farming, you need an animal, you need a ruminant, particularly like a cow or a sheep, so that in your ecosystem, you know, you have some pasture land that's provided for that animal, where, you know, because it's a ruminant, it gives more than it takes. So that ruminant because of its process in its stomach and in the bacteria, you know, you by having that cow or two in that field, it'll not only fertilize that field instead of take from it like a horse would, but it'll fertilize that field, it'll add to it, and you'll have the addition of extra.
Yeah.
And so that's free energy. So what you do is, you know, you don't have to be a meat eater. You know, you want to raise maybe organic produce, or you want to raise vegetables, whatever it is, fruit. And it's like, well, you'd need a cow. You would need one. Even if you're a vegetarian, you would need a cow because, well, you need nitrogen. You don't need to go down to Tractor Supply and have them bring a big tank of anhydrous ammonia up there and be adding to a problem. You know, and then I view meat as, well, okay, so to grow enough vegetables for your town, there's going to be several people with these farms and these cows. Meat then becomes a byproduct.
Well, they actually...
farming.
They,
see what I'm saying? Meat is the males that aren't going to be, you know, adding to, you know, your herd. And, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to do something with them. You're going to eat them.
So it
isn't grow a bunch of meat and then wonder, well, where are we going to get all the vegetation? People aren't eating, you know, I mean, if the vegetable farms were placed around the pig farm, but it's not like that. It's like, well, this town, we're just growing pigs. It's like, well, if you're only growing meat and you don't have any vegetable production, then there's no way you're going to sequester your nitrogen. There's no way, no matter, unless what you're doing is what you're saying, you're going to capture it all and maybe, you know, bottle it up and then sell it to another area and transport that so that they can use it. But
well,
see,
if you're a pig farmer, you know, or a chicken farmer or even a cattle farmer, the waste that your cattle and your wildlife or whatever are making can then in turn be changed into different types of biofuels plus fertilizer. There are sale barns where, you know, you take all your cattle to them, and they got stalls for all these cattles, and they go in there with little bobcats, and they clean up all the cow pies and whatever, and they actually pile it up, and they have big trucks to take it over, and they'll put it in a giant pile over on a piece of property they got. Well, yeah, you got this big old pile of dung that is fertilizer. You see what I mean? But if they were to do this responsibly, they could actually, you know, farmers wouldn't have to pay for fertilizer. They could put this fertilizer, instead of piling it up in some field where they're not going to use it right away, that it could just run off into the streams, they could actually take it to strategic places on farms and put this pile up there on top of the hill where when the rain comes down, that nutrients is going to wash down and fertilize their field automatically and not produce the problem. And then any runoff that would come after that, you got a buffer zone in between there using natural plants such as duckweed and watermill and stuff like that, that in turn, you know, are held back by whatever system that you design, so that it gives time for nature to absorb that. Now you've got even more product that you could turn around and recycle back in. You could recycle the same doggone fertilizer that was at the top of the hill when it gets down the bottom of the hill and the plant absorbs all this nutrients in there. You can turn around and use that plant back up at the top of the hill to recycle again. You see what I mean?
Well, I see exactly what you mean. But you do see what I mean also by just having a couple animals in an area with vegetables around it and then having hundreds of those or thousands of those compared to having like two places where there's a bunch of animals where 90% of the beef is grown. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. But we're basically pointing out, what you and me both are pointing out is that you're doing it wisely. You're farming.
Sense, exactly.
Yeah. And this is why.
I mean, if you look at the dangers and the risks, see, when they put that many animals together and then they use that kind of fertilizer and stuff, that's when the stuff, like, because the animals are so together, that's when we get these E. coli outbreaks.
Yeah.
When they shove so many animals, and I know there's ways to process that so they don't do it, but it's a byproduct of having so much concentration. It's a risk. It's like when there's many, many farms doing small things, like, there's no disease that's going to come through and kill all that and then destroy the egg market and then make a dozen eggs cost $5 a dozen.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? There's no swine flu that's going to go through and make bacon triple in prices. because in every town and every area, they can grow pigs in this country like they used to. And then at that point, that's food safety and security. So while we try to figure out ways to minimize their risk and damage to, like, in my opinion, a greedy style of farming, you know, we could sit here all day and try to minimize the risks and come up with concepts for them that they could implement to minimize their risks and their dangerous practices. But I think that, like, these younger folks, like these kind of like hippies and all these people wanting to do, like, organic things, and these young farmers that are trying to go to their local farmers market, and we're seeing a revival of that all across the nation. And it's like, these are the folks that already want to do it wisely. We're not going to have to sit and hold their hand to minimize the risks of E. coli, because we know that just following their practices, they're not going to introduce E. coli in that way. And it's like, that's helpful for everyone. That's helpful for the greater good and the health of the country. And I'm thinking in my mind, these are the people that should be receiving the subsidies to push forward, because if that style of farming is to take over again, you know, the food system will be, number one, more secure, more regional, and there'll be so much less epidemic and outbreak and potential for disease destroying the whole market.
Well,
and it's like, you know, you can't, no matter what they do with their techniques of cleaning up their nitrogen so they stop the red tide in Florida, you know, they've got a lot of work to do to cover all those other bases I just mentioned. And, you know, maybe this is a sign of the times. Like, and the beauty about it is, go ahead, man.
If I could figure out a way to get the largest environmentalist groups together and put some sort of, what do you call those, some sort of event together where actually, what's the word I'm looking for? Doggone, I hate it when I have to, a seminar, all right? Would you be willing to, like, join me in a seminar like that to explain what you're explaining, what I'm explaining, on methods by which we could actually resolve these issues without having to throw new regulations out there, just by, you know, teaching people how to strategically put things, just like your aquaponic system is a perfect example. But if we could put some sort of seminar together and actually could attract a large enough crowd of people who really care about the environment and people who really care about industry and how to make everybody benefit and solve these issues using common sense and basic science. Is that something you'd be interested in?
Well, she says, I would, in my mind, I would think we could do that exact same thing, but instead of putting on our own seminar, we could go to all the different seminars that are happening everywhere around us and present at them. So, for instance, one weekend out of the year in Pennsylvania is the Pennsylvania Sustainable Agriculture Convention, where many, many like minds come together that all have the same thing in common. We want healthy food. We want to do it wisely. And these are the kind of people that are really interested in this kind of stuff. So to do a seminar there on anything, like whether it's getting a little bit of power on the farm, you know, how to catch residual, whatever, soil health, whatever. Then, you know, and then maybe what you're saying with like a Sierra Club or something is having a conference somewhere in Michigan. And it's a big one where down people come. Well, maybe they're always looking for presenters. So if we had a good enough presentation and it got known, we would be invited to go around and share it with groups that are coming together all the time. We'd reach so many people. Well, each time those presentations happen, whether it's the Sierra Club or the PASA conference, they record those. So that the people that go to the different presentations at different times in the day, if they miss one, they can buy the DVD and watch another seminar at home after the conference.
Well, let
so
these this people podcast,
have these beautiful systems. Yes?
Let this podcast be the first step to a presentation to explaining to people what it is we're talking about, because there's been a lot of information on today's podcast. And so if anybody out there knows anybody involved in any of these groups that are getting together, having these seminars and looking for presenters, give them a copy of this podcast and let them listen to it. Because what we've explained here is the simple of the solution to actually resolving at least the portion that man is responsible for. Nature's going to do, you know, what nature does naturally, so there are going to be red blooms out there that's going to do things when things get out of balance. Nature will put in place the algae and bacteria is necessary to resolve it to get that back into balance. But if we're adding to it with our waste systems via our septic systems that might be leaking or whatever, or our farming practices, and there are methods to put in place in order to ensure that we, at the very least, reduce it to next to no impact. You see what I mean here? But all the solutions are available. You could turn what would have normally been a waste problem into a massive aquaponics solution, like what you just said. Imagine a large-scale aquaponics system to where when the runoff from this farm field was coming down into the retaining ponds or whatever, that it would make that water nutrient rich and then in turn feed the plants, and which would in turn feed the fish, and you know,
what you're saying is important to me and my mission on Earth, because in my research around my area, dealing with people, talking to real people, there's not many people around here that have conceptualized, or anybody that has even started, basically an aquaponic system. It's all based on your reservoir, where your fish is.
Yeah.
That's your nutrient reservoir. And based upon your nutrient reservoir, there, depending on what plants you want to grow, there's mathematics and studies how much you can grow per gallon. And usually it's like, you know, I mean, for me personally, I run a little bit larger reservoir than my grow beds. But other people do not. Other people will have more grow bed room than reservoir, so that they get a lot of growth out of it. So the idea is that if somebody had a swimming pool in their backyard with a little bit of acreage around it, if that swimming pool was converted to an aquaponics fish reservoir, and they were able to pump that nutrition-rich water throughout grow beds that they built, their potential for like a lettuce production could be in the millions.
Yeah.
Annually. From what I'm seeing from people using certain amounts of gallons and the production they're getting year round in some high tunnels using like a aquaponics kind of system, it's just unbelievable. And the money that's going in for the nutrients to feed the fish is not as minimal comparison to hydroponics. And even, I guess, anhydrous ammonia. I mean, well, that's kind of cheap, actually. But you see what I'm saying is that it's a low-level system is, like, on inputs.
Yeah, but you hit another key point, too, because a lot of people's concern, like, for example, the sugar farmers, they don't want you messing with their money, their livelihood. And so they will hire people to go out there and lobby senates and congresses to, you know, not regulate them, or, you know, pay people to vote a certain way or whatever. However their deal do, they're just trying to protect their own industry because they want to protect their finances. But if you show them a way that they could actually increase their profits by not having to pay for things like fertilizer or anhydrous ammonia, and ways that they could actually use what would have been their natural waste products to then in turn be their new fertilizer. You see what I mean? If you show them a benefit to how you're not gonna hit them in the wallet, you know, negatively, you're going to actually help them add to their wallet by saving them money on fuel cost and fertilizer and stuff like that. They'd be more apt to work with you as opposed
well,
to.
I agree completely. And you know, in a world when really, you know, where the fruits of your hands of your, you know, the labor, the fruits of your labor shine as the wealth of this world, that would probably have already happened, because I feel like with the people need to understand the farm bill. I need to even understand it better. It's thousands of pages, but
yeah.
Sugar is subsidized heavily.
Yeah.
And what is not subsidized heavily is lettuce, tomatoes, cucumbers, onions, garlic, zucchini, squash, the list goes on, healthy food. Those are considered specialty crops. I've done my research on this. If you want to grow specialty crops, you know, you can get some money for that, but it's minimal. The main crops that are subsidized, everything that is not a... So there's only, it's so interesting. When I'm reading the farm bill, understand the last...
I lost you there, Ted. Did you lose your signal? Uh-oh. We lost Ted there for a second. So, until I get him back, we'll have to see what's going on. Looks like it might be on my side. Shows I ain't got no internet connection on that computer. Ah! Alright. Let's just see if we can resolve that while Ed burn it. Alright, folks. So, basically, if you know anybody out there into, environmental issues and people that's concerned about the red tide, try to send this podcast to them if you can. I'll try to figure out what the heck is going on there. Open troubleshooter. Ed, burn it. Alright. Anyway, I'll have to wait for that thing to resolve itself. So, if we can get somebody to, okay, there we go. Looks like it came back. Alright. Let me get my brain straight here. So, what I've showed you today is that there's a problem out there that they call the red tide, and it is causing fish die-offs in Florida, which is concerning a lot of people, because of not just the fish dying off, but health problems as well. And so, basically, you need a solution for that. Obviously, people want to be able to go to the beach and enjoy the beach and all that and not have to worry about all this stuff. But you got to get down to the basic understanding, and that's what today's show is about, is to try to get it to the basic understanding of what actually is the cause and what is the effect and the symptoms and all that, and how to put in place resolutions in order to resolve this issue. See, now, the sugar fields out there in Florida, they have to fertilize in order to be able to get their stuff to grow. But if they understood a bit about what we're talking about here today, they don't have to stop fertilizing. They could actually follow the water word, because they got to water their plants somehow or another. Whether it be, through waterways that they, irrigate in or whatever. But either way, if they started at the beginning there and then they fertilize from that point and let their runoff go down into the farm field and then fertilize that, and then they had something in place down there to catch any potential nutrient runoff, and then take that nutrient runoff and turn it into a plus, such as biodiesel or new fertilizer or even fish food or whatever, they could turn their business into a super efficient business to where now they actually have another product to sell. So just by doing it wisely, you can actually resolve this issue that is the portion that man has caused by, this particular scenario, the red tide out there. You're not adding to the problem anymore. And as far as the lake, like Lake Okeechobee being polluted with deals, if you was going to have any kind of, regulations or whatever, it would need to be more about where, the people living around this lake, how they're actually, contributing, whether their septic system might be leaking into it or whatever, or maybe if their boat, or if they're dumping their toilets over the boat and adding bacteria and nutrients to the... Let's head back in there. Yeah, I don't know what happened there, Ted.
That dropped.
Yeah, something happened on my side, I think. The network shut down there on that one side there for a second. We didn't lose our broadcast or nothing. It was just on this particular computer. But anyway, I was just explaining that if people want to try to resolve this issue as far as to the extent of what, man has inadvertently added to the cause, we can clean up the, you can still have your sugar farm. You can add to your products that you have available to you now by basically producing your own fertilizer, producing biodiesels that would run your tractors. And if you want to go into the aquaponics side, actually having a new deal where you could actually grow fish at the same time. All of which are helping to produce a balance in the system while you're actually making your money and growing your crop. and other industries might want to be neighboring you, because if you've got all this nutrient runoff, they've got free fertilizer down the line. And if used wisely, none of this would get down into Lake Okeechobee, such as in Florida. And if you actually pay attention to how people are disposing of any waste products, that, like, if they're out there on their boat and they're dumping their commode over the deal, that should be a no-no that they should understand. If they have an incentive to not dump it over the boat, like such as, hey, every time you bring your boat in, dump your waste products into this right here, which is going to this factory, which is going to turn it into other fuel, and for you providing this service and dumping those waste products into this, we'll give you this little receipt so that next time you go to buy fuel for your boat, you get a discount, because you're actually helping the problem, or, you know, being part of the solution instead of part of the problem. So, wisely done, you could get people to start, you know, because everybody wants to save money. If they want to save money on their vacation or their, you know, fuel costs to ride their boats around out there and have their fun and all that, they could take all their waste products, even plastics or trash or whatever, and all this could be recycled into the system and do just like nature does to begin with, and nothing gets wasted. And in the process, you got clean, fresh lakes that you've got to enjoy, and everybody's happy. And it doesn't even have to go into the political arguing and debate over the whole deal. It's just people doing things wisely in order to keep this from, you know, becoming a problem. The sugar companies...
Yeah, I agree with that completely, you know, but and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but, you know, I hope that I got to verbalize that the difference between a specialty crop and a crop before our internet got cut off.
Not
there.
Sure, just go ahead and redo that real quick.
Well, you know, it's important to understand that that sugar farmer, or that farmer down in Florida that's pumping that anhydrous, and you're saying, well, if we could get them to grow, you know, differently or whatnot, and I'm thinking, you know, until we understand that, like, every other crop besides corn, soybeans, canola, sugar, you know, a few other crops that are the industrial crops, everything else is a specialty crop. And those gentlemen that are growing, you know, receiving subsidies on the multi-million-dollar farms where the action's really happening, they only stick to crops. Like, they don't grow specialty crops. They don't grow Brussels sprouts, cabbage, kale, you know, tomatoes, onions, peppers. Those are all specialty crops. And there's no subsidy money in specialty crops. And I think until we change our language and, you know, we start working, you know, with the political side to change the language of the farm bill and say, wait a second, you know, sugar is sugar. You know, that's that on the food guide pyramid, that says use sparingly and you don't need to use very much of it. That shouldn't be a crop. That should be a specialty crop. I don't think we need to subsidize it or if people are not growing it. And, you know, with corn, it's a misnomer. It's like, well, the sweet corn that we eat off the cob is a specialty crop. The corn that's a crop that's subsidized is used for making corn oil, corn syrup, and food for animals. And that's corn. Like, the corn, you think of corn, maybe you get it at KFC on the stick or whatever, that's a specialty crop. And that's a kind of a problem to me, is because it's hard to get our multi-million dollar farmer friends on board when they're being subsidized to grow or not grow soybeans depending on the year. Well, soybeans, I mean, they're not making tofu out of it. It's being made to make soy oil and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's that used sparingly on the food guide pyramid that the government puts out. So I don't understand why they subsidize the foods that they say use sparingly and we all admit are making us sick. And then we consider all the other food that it says in the food guide pyramid to eat, like vegetables and fruits, to be specialty crops. That to me hurts as a farmer, and it's why that man in Florida that grows sugar doesn't want to switch to something that grows some kind of really good high quality rice he could be growing down. Some kind of a golden rice, but that forbidden rice, you know, it's black because of all the nutrients in it.
Yeah.
He could be growing a couple hundred acres of that, you know, and feeding the country with it healthy, but no, that's a specialty crop. Rice is a specialty crop. And it's like, you know, well, maybe rice is a bad example because I think we need to eat our greens more. But if we're going to still sit around and think of all the brassica families, all the cabbage, kale, all that as a specialty crop, I think we've got a long way to go towards we get the health and efficient farming.
Well, Stephen, thanks for letting me hear that. Oh, you're more than welcome, man. That's great information. Stephen Gibbons said, if you leave a problem to the government, the only solution they can implement is to create new legislation and a tax and use some of that money to subcontract the problem to the lowest bidder who claims they may be able to manage the problem but not solve it, as that would stop the funding and the business of red tide management would collapse. So he's got a point there. The whole entire system, you know, basically is based off of money. People want to make money, and so that's where you're finding all the problems, is that they don't want to lose their money, so they're not going to want to solve the problem. I wrote a letter to the governor of Florida, and I still haven't got a response yet. I'll have to check my email. Maybe it came in during the time of this show, and if it does, I'll come back and share it with you, but basically put a little bit of information and a contact so that they could contact me and I could have this talk with them. But we have, folks, we have the solutions to resolve our part in the issue. You know, we're adding to what nature would have already done anyway. If things got out of balance, nature puts these algaes and bacteria into place in order to balance everything back out. Well, when things get severely out of balance, then you see all these things like we've seen out there with the die-offs of the fish and the dolphins and all that. We have the technology, we have the knowledge to resolve it. Now we have to have the resolve to actually follow through with the solutions. And I would put out here on the table a whole bunch of solutions just in today's show alone. What I'm asking people to do for me out there is to take this podcast and send it on to environmentalist groups. Send it on to your government representatives and have them listen into what I have to say here, what Ted's been talking about. So you don't have to worry about losing your funding or your research or your business or anything. It's just about maybe doing something a little wiser, and in that process of doing something wiser, actually benefiting yourself financially, because now you don't have to pay for fertilizer. Now you don't have anhydrous ammonia sitting on your property for somebody to want to come around and steal so that they can make methamphetamines and such. Because there's no need for the anhydrous ammonia if you understand how to get the same reaction from what nature's already provided. And then if you are actually take the time to understand where, when it rains on your property, where's the path that your water is actually going, you could strategically place your fertilizer, such as your cattle manure, on the top of the hill, and when that washes down into your cropland, it actually fertilizes for you. So you don't even have to go out there and fertilize. You could use what nature's already provided to fertilize. And just as a backup plan, which also has benefits, if you have the easiest way for me to say it would be like a moat around the bottom of your property, where you know your water is going to go down this way before it actually leaves your property and goes into other people's waterways. You have a deal where you're using a natural plant native to Florida, which is duckweed, that is basically, its job is filtration. It filters up the nutrients and contaminants out of the water and stuff like that. And then you can turn around and recycle your fertilizer that you got at the top of the hill by gathering up a portion of this duckweed and water mill every so many days or whatever, because this stuff will grow so rapidly in nutrient-rich water that you got fertilizer, you got fish food, you got biodiesel capabilities, and if you're not using herbicides or pesticides on the top of your deal, then you can also use this as people food. You know, and for your cattle as well. But if you're using duckweed as people food, there's things you have to know. Huh?
Does the duckweed keep down the mosquito population off the top of the pond?
Well, anytime there's no stagnation of water, then you're not going to have the mosquito problem that you've got.
People are always worried about the mosquitoes down there in Florida, right? Aren't they worried about that?
Yeah, and so all you got to do is have an understanding of how mosquitoes even function to be able to resolve that issue as well. There are natural ways to get rid of mosquitoes, you know, and so...
I love bats.
Yeah, all we need... is a little bit of common sense. All we need is some people to come to the table. That's, you know the people out there...
Can I add in some about the mosquitoes?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, what if they, down there in Florida, get rid of all their mosquitoes, they put in a bunch of bats, and then collect that bat guano, has got all that, I think it's potassium or phosphorus in there, whatever, is awesome.
Well, there's everything... Let me explain it to you like this, and we're got down to the last 10 minutes of this show. Let me explain it to you like this. Nature wastes absolutely nothing. Let that absorb in. Nature does not waste anything. Everything that nature does, nature reuses, recycles. Everything that you do, nature reuses and recycles. Where the problem falls is when we overproduce one product, whether it be a waste product or not, we overproduce one thing and it interferes with what nature's trying to do down here. Nature has a backup plan for when you over-fertilize your field. It puts in place a filtration system. But you have to understand that once this filtration system is put into place, if it is a continuous problem from your side, it will amplify what nature's trying to do. Nature doesn't have enough time to clean this water up as fast as you're polluting it, so it basically shuts that ecosystem down and basically takes it off the table for, you know, fish life to be able to grow inside there. When you get an understanding of what's going on from the beginning and now what nature's going to do when you do what you did, then now you can understand how to work with nature to turn what nature's doing at that particular time into a plus, and now you've got biofuel, fish food, fertilizer, and worst case scenario, people food if you understand how to cook this particular type of plant. You know, they got little spiny roots, and you wouldn't want to eat these raw or anything like that. You have to cook them in a certain fashion, but they're highly nutrients and protein rich because of the way you fertilized your deal and the way that it absorbed. But if you are using pesticides on your farmland, that pesticide will also get absorbed in there and thus for making that duckweed unedible to you and your wildlife without potential health hazards from that point on. So I understand the processes from A to B, then you can find the solution, you can enact the solution, and everybody downstream of you is going to be happy because they're going to have clean water to swim in, it's not going to be caked with algae, and if they do their job down there on that lake, and the people that go to visit that lake aren't throwing waste into that lake, you know, to add to the bacteria and to the algae problem, then that lake will stay in balance. And if you introduce the proper fish where they need to be, the fish will help to eat up some of the duckweed so that the duckweed doesn't get completely out of hand. And you can balance nature from the farmland all the way down to the seashores and therefore saving the fish from the red tide and the toxins that are released by these particular types of algae. Folks, we got the answers. Now, if I can get anybody to listen to what I'm trying to say, I don't know everything there is to know. Ted don't know everything there is to know, but we've done enough research from his research to my research to all the other brilliant people out there that can add to the deal. We can get all these folks to the table and we can get this information out to the average Joe so that they understand that even the person going to the beach makes a difference on the ecosystem out there. We can work and play in perfect harmony with nature and do it in a respectful and a manner by which we actually repeat what nature does, and we recycle everything. Nothing gets wasted, and we can still live happily ever after with our technologies and have fun. It's as simple as that. So, if you listen to this podcast and it makes sense to you, and it's worthy of sharing, send it up the line to somebody. Send it to somebody who has a voice out there who can repeat it. Otherwise, I'm just shouting into a box, and nobody's paying attention. Everything that Ted said here today, it adds to everything, all the solutions to it. There are ways by which we can be farming, and people raising their cattle next to the farmland. Everybody downstream is doing what they need to do, and by the time it hits the oceans, everything's fine. Nature's happy. And when nature's happy, people are happy. So with that said, Ted, you got any last thing you want to say before we leave up out of here?
No, that was you. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for your input, because it definitely does make a difference. And I'm going to edit a portion of this podcast, and I'm going to try to put it up on Shaziz Radio YouTube, because I hadn't put nothing up there for a while, but got to take out anything that might be a copyright issue. But either way, it's good information, and I'm trying to pass it on to people, and hopefully people will pass this podcast down the road. If you got a big YouTube channel out there and you're wanting information to try to resolve the Florida issue, the Lake Okeechobee issue, or any other issue out there related to the same subject, pass it on. That's what it's all about. And if you got something to add to it, join us on the next show, and we'll work it out together. That's what Shaziz Radio is all about. ShazizRadio.com, Super Chat, join us in there. Go over and join People for People Radio on their network, and don't forget to check out Wolf Spirit Radio and other networks that are affiliated as well. This is how we get things accomplished. If you want to make the world better, one pop.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.